haggard, sleep-deprived, tortured and submissive. Yes, it's your very own Children in Need telethon producer. You can do with it what you want. After Friday's orgy of incompetence, it's little more than a husk. It's had to face not only the endless cavalcade of selfless celebrities who've offered their services in a free and non-image-enhancing gesture of otherwise you'd never know I was still alive generosity, it's also had to cope with Sue Cook. Continuing her game attempt to put Mogadon out of business, her repertoire of immortal catchphrases like...
The auto cue's broken.
Her insatiable appetite for the word and her general tendency to be slightly less spontaneous than the Queen's speech.
Remember, lovey, no ad-libs, they're bloody awful. Don't say please. Right. Don't say... No, new total, yeah, that's right. Stick with the total.
We've got a new total now.
Oh, that's my terrific. God, she's boring. Send the belt issue her arms. Send the belt issue her arms.
Rob is staying in the marquee at the moment.
No, not the marquee, you stupid horse. Don't say Don't say No.
Yes, your very own Children in Need producer, plus the only emotional language it understands, which is to weep, sob, scratch deep open wounds in your arms when you hear the words poor little child, terminal, best friend was a dog, run over, laugh outrageously when someone splits their trousers or says naughty things like willy or poo, and burst into spontaneous and loud applause at the magical rune, the round table.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM politics show on Friday the 16th of July 2021. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And joining us here in the studio is author of 9/11, The New Evidence, and next door neighbour to the UK's first COVID super spreader back in March 2020. That's Ian Henshaw. In part two, Jovenel Moïse, the Haiti president, was assassinated in his bed. The very poor upstart nation with almost zero COVID deaths, which has blocked any vaccine rollout, saying they don't want to take part in a human experiment. Now the president's dead. Yet another president who has been against the vaccines and or against Bill Gates that's died. And Mike Yardley is a former army officer who believes the case rate is being vastly exaggerated by the PCR test. But more importantly, that he believes the British government has been conducting a psychological warfare operation on the British public. And the Theranos medical testing fraud scandal, which was mentioned by Alex Craner a fortnight ago on this show. Who is Elizabeth Holmes? And how's her fraud case going? We have a close look at that, and I'll be putting some links up to a documentary about the Theranos medical testing fraud scandal, which Alex believes was a kind of precursor for some of the weird measures that have been going on during the COVID-19 pandemic. And special guest tonight is retired immunologist Stanley Laham, who has patients in the Dominican Republic. He explains why he believes the US government may have been behind the assassination of the president there. Stanley also tells us why you should not get vaccinated if you've already had COVID. He explains what's going on in your body so you can actually make that decision with informed consent or informed dissent. And how to tell if you've got COVID. And you could, if say, for example, you couldn't get a test at the time, how do you tell if you've actually had COVID or not? And the great killer wasn't pneumonia, was it? But the cytokine storm in the lungs. Stanley explains exactly what's going on there and suggests some immune system moderators that can prevent the cytokine storm that the SARS causes in the lungs or reduce its effect. But the protocols right around the Western world never actually said that there's something you can use to treat COVID to stop you going to hospital. Well, Stanley explains that's all wrong, and Conspiracy Classics moves on from the June 2021 Out in Child's expose of Freemasonry and Satanism, which we've been covering for the last few weeks, as we head back to 1980 for Conspiracy Classics number 11. It's Anthony Sutton, author of Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, amongst other titles. We hear a clip tonight about big American corporations producing armaments for Nazi Germany right through World War II, and how they also avoided getting their factories bombed, which were actually behind enemy lines. But first, celebrations up on the downs here in Bristol at Ladies Mile yesterday, Bubbly and Rounders. And the chief case officer for the Open Spaces Society who was up there, who didn't want to be interviewed. And the Downs Committee and the Travellers, let's shut the road, says Steve Smith, the new Lord Mayor. The road that the Travellers are parked on, he wants closed, but they would just move around the corner. Is there really any point in that? And also the amnesty for Northern Ireland killings. Once more, putting the crooks and killers, MI5 and others, above the law. Just as Boris abandons the Unionists in Northern Ireland and ditches the 1801 Act of Union, is the British Army collusion in creating the Troubles an inconvenient truth worth ditching the province for? And is the UK breaking up? So, censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information, sadly the norm in the British mass media today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and cartel-run printing presses of the Fourth Industrial Revolution's Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let us know and we'll credit you here. Now, joining us is Ian Henshaw, author of 9/11 and New Evidence. Hi, Ian, and Hi. Welcome to The Politics Show. So, what are you up to now? You've already published this book, 9/11 and New Evidence, which was did quite well, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, the first book I published was a sort of, you know, a real big bestseller, to be honest. You know, the Daily Mail liked it and serialised it. Well, basically, my publishers have been taken over by a huge global conglomerate called Little Brown. And funnily enough, they are prepared to publish my book for the 20th anniversary, so long as A, it's seriously upgraded, and B, I write an afterword, which I've just finished doing.
When you say upgraded, what do they decide?
Revised.
So at the end of the day, who is going to decide? Is it just you editing this?
Yeah, no. The publishers will stop you, you know, but I'm not going to push beyond any space. They haven't told me they want anything missed out. But of course, publishers are the real owners of in the mainstream system.
Gosh, it's frustrating, isn't it? I've just had to bring these two books out, my World War II book and my Secret Government book, through self-publishing, even though actually both of them were commissioned by publishers originally. They've, for whatever reason, decided, we don't want that now, we changed our mind. Yeah. So you've got to bring it out, publish it yourself. So anyway, look, the main thing for you and for us right now has got to be, give us a bit of a taste. If you're going to update it, what extra little bits and pieces have you found out about 9/11 since it was first published?
Well, I'd say that the one thing that I've found out that goes against 9/11 skeptics a little bit, it doesn't really, is that I think they were wrong to say that there wasn't a plane hitting the Pentagon. I think it seems to me now, I mean, I've been very open-minded on this for years, but I've now come down on the side of the, yes, it was almost certainly a 757 as well. Who was steering it is another question altogether. And that is really what the question that, you know, what you call a paper trail question rather than a physical question.
Is there any film or footage of it actually flying into the Pentagon, hitting the Pentagon, anything like that?
To cut a long story short, no. But there's a lot of eyewitnesses.
I remember on Newsnight some years ago, they said, well, the US have just released footage of the plane hitting the Pentagon, which they then showed. And it was so short, you just saw something and went bang.
Yeah,
and Jeremy Vine said, well, I can't
Jeremy
see any
Paxman.
Jeremy Paxman said, well, I can't see any plane there.
Yeah. Did anyone see a plane? I didn't see a plane. Yeah. So what's convinced you that there's something to it?
The evidence trail, the lampposts that were knocked over, the academics who went in and drew a damage sketch. But the most interesting thing is that we were conned. I reckon we were righteously conned with some misinformation. What happened was that the National Transport Safety Board in America, who, of course, are White House controlled, amazingly released this video, which I featured in my book, 9/11 and New Evidence, clearly showing that the plane must have flown above the Pentagon. But since then, some serious, you know, brainy people have actually gone back to the raw data from the actual black box, if you trust it at all, of course, and it was miscalculated. That video, which so many people have seen, from appearing to show that the plane didn't flew over the Pentagon. Of course, there are no eyewitnesses to that happening. There never were, but it's always been the claim of some skeptics. And that was a hoax. I've been hoaxed. But I must say, the almost everything else that I was saying, I don't want to sound too conceited, Tony. you can give listeners your own opinion about this, but I think pretty much everything I was right about.
Well, you can be reasonably conceited, because the thing is, your book is actually quite a small book physically. It's, A6 or something, yeah. Quite a small thing. It's easy to carry around, and it's got pretty much everything seems to be in there. Yeah. You know, it's a very good summary, I think, of what's there. I'm not just saying that. Yeah. I mean, I've got a copy at home. I have to, you know, if there's something definitive I want to reference about 9/11, it's a good place to go to get those references, you know. And it's, you know, so... So you're re-releasing this as a new title,
it's
is it?
It's being released as an e-book.
Oh. Oh, not a real book. Oh, that's no good.
That's exactly what I thought, and they invited me to do it on the 10th anniversary, and I said no. I went, better not say what I said.
Oh, okay.
But I said no. But now, 20 years later, why not? You know, it's history in a way, important history, but it sort of is in
so
a way.
Is there any sort of event for a e-book launch allowed? I mean, it doesn't sound like the same sort of thing where you can sign copies of a paper book when you're launching the book, the publisher's helping you to launch it. Is it a sort of online, I don't know, like a Zoom thing or what?
I don't think so.
It's nothing.
I don't know. I mean,
a load of emails being sent out to a bunch of bookshops or e-book shops,
I think. I mean, Tony, I'm like you. You know, this is all stuff that I can do without in my own personal life. But, you know, apparently quite a lot of people do buy e-books.
They do.
And the course also for the author, the royalties are much bigger because nobody's got to actually print a book. You know, that is the advantage, as we know.
Can you give us a little bit of an insight into how much you've made out of this? Because obviously some people thinking about writing a book on a subject, you know, they're thinking, well, how much is it actually going to bring me in? And obviously you've chosen quite a good topic there. 9/11 is something that you know a lot about. You, as part of the 9/11 Truth Campaign in Britain, knew a lot about. And so you can do something which is completely against the grain.
Mm.
But solidly evidenced, so it's obviously going to do reasonably well. Can I ask you what can you get an income from writing books like this?
I think you could if you were very professional. I'm much more professional than I am, because I decide what I want to write about, whereas really what you should do if you want to make money is sort of analyze the market.
Well, yeah.
You know, and sort of do what the public wants. But
do yoga books or something.
Do yoga books. Or there's one famous 9/11 skeptic who I won't mention, who does books on planting plants at midnight. What is it? Is it Steiner method or
okay.
something?
Okay. Yes.
So I don't know if they did that to make money. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's like everything in this world. The top very few make a lot of money, and the bottom 95% don't make any money.
And what about the publishers? Because I've had a terrible relationship with publishers, to be quite frank with you, over the years. Promise everything, deliver nothing.
Yeah.
What about yours?
Well, you have to understand that under capitalism, the publisher is the owner of your book from the moment you sign your contract with them. And that's how they think. Mm. You know, as far as they're concerned, they see you a bit like a horse, you know, that sort of does the pulling while they're cleverly there in the sort of command position. I mean, that is capitalist publishing, unfortunately.
Okay, anything else in the book you think we should know about that's worth getting it and downloading it, or whatever you do with these e-books?
Well, all I can say is I've done... I mean, I could spend the whole of this programme reading you out the various points that I've been analysing.
You mentioned Philip Marshall just before we sat down, didn't you?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, he is an interesting character, and I think, in a way, he's almost like a lodestone, touchstone character when it comes to 9/11, because you can read his stuff still. He was a professional pilot that had flown for the Secret Services as well in the United States. And it must have taken a lot of courage to say, well, actually, this is too important. I'm not going to keep silent about this. The pressure is obviously subtle, as you know, the Secret Services work like this, is to try and silence people, make you think, well, if I speak out, something might happen to me, so I'm not going to. Philip chose the other route. I mean, we obviously, in this country, we've got examples like Dr. David Kelly, being
they
murdered.
They can drive you. And what they do is they set up a situation so that you might have committed suicide because they've been so shitty, bad, horrible to you, you know, and like midnight calls, threatening death and so on, you know, seriously unpleasant. And after a few months, if somebody's at all weak, you know, that grinds them down a bit. And then they get into that position. Their friends will probably say, oh, God, well, he was a bit disturbed. You know, he's worried about something or other. And then they can just pop you. Or maybe you will. A lot of men do commit suicide in America. You know, it's a high cause of death, especially veterans.
I noticed I think it was 2 weeks ago, we had John McAfee so-called committing suicide, who's the developer of the antivirus software. I think what happened is he'd been arrested in Spain under an extradition warrant to the US for tax, something to do with tax.
Yeah.
Quite clearly, he was an insider in the US for many years. He was a very wealthy individual. He was preparing to fight the extradition case. Suddenly, he's found dead in his cell, a little bit like Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
So how do we tell, and maybe Martin can get you on this, when somebody high profile like this, most recently John McAfee, the antivirus guru in the US, is found dead in their cell, so-called suicide. What are the indications that there may have actually been foul play?
Well, the first thing people have got to realise is that it's quite possible that there is foul play. One of the first barriers you've got to get through is surely they don't do stuff like that. And, of course, the track record is exactly the opposite. And it's rather bizarre because, of course, the general bien pensant opinion is that in Russia you can get murdered for any kind of criticism of the government, which is not entirely true. Some people do, and that, you know, there's a system developing there, whereas in the West there's this long history of people being murdered by the government. Don't forget the Soviet Union didn't murder people like that. It just sent them to prison for 25 years or kicked them out of the country. They didn't have to murder people.
Another one is Aaron Swartz, the inventor of Reddit. Yeah. For example, is another one who was just, oh, well, there's almost no questions asked. In the case of John McAfee, the most recent one, and we really will get talking about Philip Marshall in a minute, but the most recent one, John McAfee, his ex-wife has said there's no way he was suicidal. I was talking to him the same day. He was looking forward to chatting to me the next day. We were preparing the case. He was looking forward to fighting through the courts in Spain and in the United States, looking to get some positive publicity for it, and also to blow the whistle on he thought was a corrupt US justice system. So the idea that he was actually committed suicide, I think, is completely almost impossible.
Yeah. One system I've noticed here with David Kelly, but I think it happens quite often, they find somebody who claims to know the person very well, who then says that they weren't surprised because they were so upset and they probably did commit suicide. Yeah. I mean, in the case of David Kelly, there was a BBC reporter who I don't think particularly knew Kelly at all, and he was suddenly John Kelly's best friend, you know. And almost, you know, Piers Morgan's actually almost been in that role with Diana. Because he had a very close relationship. He did have quite a close relationship with her, but only on the business level, you know, and on professional level. And, you know, he was up there saying, oh, well, let's just let her go peacefully. I mean, Piers Morgan said some quite good things in the past.
He has also, and of course he reversed that in the documentary Unlawful Killing, which was made by Keith Allen. In that documentary, he's poo-pooing the idea that she wasn't assassinated.
That she wasn't
Diana.
Assassinated.
Yeah. He was. In fact, I think he says, well, MI6, don't do things like this. Come on, of course they do. So, you know, I think this is maybe Piers Morgan has either been persuaded to change his mind, or he's one of those people who I think puts all sorts of different points of view. Maybe he holds different points of view all at the same time. But anyway, let's go back to Philip Marshall, because he was a fascinating character. Can you just tell us what you know about him?
Yeah, he was a very, very plausible sort of guy. You can listen to him on YouTube if they haven't cut him out yet, but I'm sure you can easily find one of his talks. And he just exudes, he's one of those people who exudes authority, you know. And he's the real deal. He really has. I mean, we have to trust this, you know, that, that people have corroborated this. I haven't myself corroborated it. But he really was an airline pilot who flew big planes. He explains how to learn to fly the 9/11 planes. The handbook's 1,000 pages. But, you know, if you're getting trained as a pilot, then, you know, you've got to read that 1,000-page handbook before they'll even take you up in a plane. And where does that put these guys, half of whom couldn't speak English properly, or perhaps all of whom? So, you know, he's got a lot of damage he can inflict on the official story. His explanation, which is why I think initially they let him be, is that actually, you know, there were hijackers, there were suicide hijackers. And his line is that, but you've got to think about how they were trained. I mean, I still think it's more likely there were some sort of autopilot takeover. But anyway, he found this secret Saudi air base in America where he thinks they were trained. Probably not the people who were named as the 9/11 hijackers, but probably other people who had more skills. So anyway, he's going around stirring things up and he's saying, get it into the courts, get it into the courts. And there is a way that the courts aren't 100% corrupt. You know, they're sort of 95%, but, you know, they more slow things down than actually. Anyway, it's another story.
Let's just focus for a second on his. Philip Marshall was somebody who was a very confident, very authoritative, very articulate. Everything he said was referenced in one way or another, so you could check it out. To have somebody who's authoritative like that is actually a real problem, isn't it? I think, is it Daniel Jawenko is another one
who died.
Yeah, again, who died, I think it was in a car crash.
Yeah, he crashed into a tree on an open road.
And he was an expert in controlled demolition, is that right?
Yeah, he was.
So various people who've been, you know, speaking out, experts on this topic. And of course, you mentioned Diana. It's one of my favourite topics. I try and let other people bring Diana up. But of course, was an expert on the royal family.
Yes.
She was an absolute mega insider who knew everybody intimately and could dish the dirt on them, you know. So that's another reason that maybe she was dispatched. Okay, so you're going on to talk about what happened to Philip.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's. He turned up to. You know, he lived in this gated community. Quite wealthy, you know, and they probably had some sort of security there. And basically, he was killed, and his two young, his teenage children were killed, and his dog was killed, all with, you know, what looked very much like a professional hit. There was issues about silencers. Independent investigators went down there to check on the story from the neighbours, and it all pointed to a professional hit. And you know he there was no evidence that he was contemplating suicide, and even if he was, you know, why kill the dog and the two children? That's what professional hitmen do. They go for the dog first because it might make a noise. So you know, and then I think personally the most suspicious thing of all was that the local investigator and police turned up and said instantly, or, you know, very, very early stage, they said there was no question it was anything but suicide, when there was obviously, you know, some question, at least, if not a very big question. So there we are. That encourages anybody else who might want to speak out, doesn't it?
Okay, what about the bigger picture with September the 11th attacks? Many people would say, well, it's 20 years ago, Ian, you know, it's history. What's the point?
Well, the point is that it did change things in a very big way. It's an example of something which a certain type of Marxist historian would say is irrelevant, because it's only the big forces of history that are important. But here was a case where America was brought into the Middle East in a much, much bigger way than they ever had been, even then. Israel's stature in the world rocketed. They were suddenly, from being a pariah state, they were being experts welcomed in to train your local security forces on anti-terrorism. The arms industry had a huge... So basically, big structural changes happened as a result of 9/11, And it was just purely as a result of that. And also, we know now from the official story that they had plenty of warning. They could easily have stopped it. If you follow the official story, they could easily have stopped it. So actually, instead of being party to the deaths of goodness knows how many 100,000 people in the Middle East, all we had to do was to identify the incompetent people in the CIA, optimistically speaking incompetent, pessimistically speaking in it up to their eyeballs. Let's investigate them.
So in a way, with the Philip Marshall murder, you've got the cover-up being done by the police, and in a way, in the bigger scale of things, with the 9/11 attacks themselves, there's a cover-up going on within the government. I would imagine the FBI, the CIA, there's another couple of sort of... So you have got to make sure that whoever is likely to investigate your crime is part of the crime.
Yeah, yeah. Well, funnily enough... there's a guy called Chertoff who was drafted into the FBI about 6 months before 9/11 in the head of the anti-terrorism branch. He'd also defended terrorists as a lawyer, by the way. And he was there for the next 6 months afterwards supervising the 9/11 investigation by the FBI. And later on, he was Homeland Security. And surprise, surprise, he was part of the project for a new American century.
Oh, God. Well, look, there's always... I mean, the thing is, there's lots of speculation, loads of different theories about what happened. It'd be great to, just with you and Martin, in the next 5 minutes, let's just try and pin a few things down about things like, Martin, about... remote control planes, is that feasible? Because somebody got onto airplanes. Those airplanes took off. They went somewhere, and then did the same planes appear or different planes appear at the Twin Towers?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of time being wasted trying to look at every detail, and I'm not saying that it's not worth doing. But what you really got to do, and what I tried to do from the get go, is just concentrate on the stuff which is basic. Planes can be flown from the ground. Global Hawk technology has existed since the 1970s. So it's perfectly feasible for the deep state in the US to take
Actually,
over those
John
planes.
John F. Kennedy's brother was working on it in World War II, I think, wasn't he?
Exactly.
Remote control.
And of course, you then had Condoleezza Rice coming on and said, trains crashing into buildings, who could have thought of that? And we didn't see it, even though they were actually carrying out an exercise on the day, planes clashing into buildings. I mean, that's a pretty basic one. And the other basic one is the collapse of WTC-7, which is a third building that collapses at 5 o'clock in the afternoon after the other two buildings, and no plane hit it. And, of course, a third scientific thing would be, why does a plane fire, which is basically kerosene fire, turn buildings not just to rubble but to dust? There's just not enough kilojoules.
Well, actually, those fire... We've played them on this show in the past, the recordings of the firefighters saying, hey, guys, it's okay, the fire's out here. And then apparently the fire destroys the building.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically a stage show. It's theatre presented to the public around the world as news, really. That's what's going on.
Yeah, and the other final point I'd make is that I've got a track record of carrying out these kind of false flag attacks going back to the 1940s. And if you know the history of NATO, it was a very big one. And a very dangerous one, and caused all kinds of problems. But the bombing of Bologna railway station that killed 80 odd people in 1980, just as heinous in every possible way. It's not about the numbers, it's about the intentions, isn't it? And the kind of standard operating procedures that they have. And we were talking earlier about people being assassinated. Berezovsky got murdered in Britain, in Surrey, and the coroner refused to write it off as suicide. He said, I'm not going to give this as suicide. And, of course, the British state wanted it to be seen to be suicide. And, of course, that's somebody who was murdered in British jurisdiction. And, of course, we're going to come on to Northern Ireland later on. I mean, this is the way Western states have always operated. So there's nothing surprising about any of it.
Ian?
The big picture. I think Martin's pretty much on track there. You know... I wouldn't commend people. I mean, I've spent a lot of time, as you can imagine, looking into 9/11 in the last 20 years. I would suggest to activists, and I think this is one reason why the orthodox left isn't very interested in things like 9/11, is you can spend an awful lot of time investigating, and I now realise that, some of the more speculative websites that I've spent time on in the past are just that, very speculative. And when you actually have to come and, back things up with references for a publisher, you realise just how much speculative stuff there is out there that doesn't really have a huge amount of evidence to support it. You know, there was somebody saying that there were laser beam weapons being used to destroy the towers, for instance. You know,
I would argue that all of that stuff should be left to subsequent police investigation. What you really need to establish is they're telling lies.
Yeah.
That's all you need to do.
Well, just one little thing to do with 9/11. I remember reading a lot of stuff at the time by a guy called Jim Fetzer in the States and scratching my head thinking, well, what is this? You know, this doesn't really seem to be backed up by anything. And lo and behold, 2 years ago, he pops up at the Christchurch mosque massacre saying, the whole thing's a hoax, folks. It never happened, you know. Mm. So there are people, I think, out there who are professional disinformation merchants.
Well, he's got status as a professor. I mean, because I looked into him because he was going around slagging me. So, you know, like an egotistical writer's are, you know.
Isn't that interesting? So he's actually a prof at a university.
Oh, yeah, and he's an ex-Marine as well.
Right. So he's saying that the Christchurch mosque massacre was just staged and it was just filmed and it never really happened.
How he got his job. And it's a serious professorship. You'd have to check it out. I could have told you, but not from memory. Somewhere like Yale or Harvard.
I mean, this is also, Martin, part of the conspiracy, isn't it, really? That you actually got, not only have you got voices at the time, as Ian was saying, this guy from the BBC, for example, saying about David Kelly, oh, I think, you know, he was very nervous, blah, blah. So you've got people at the time, you also got professionals who have been tasted up to say, hey, guys, this is the official line, let's stick to it.
Well, if you carry out a thought experiment, if you are going to carry out these false flag attacks, and they do exist, and they have been carried out, you know, criminal investigations in Italy and elsewhere have definitely uncovered this, then you also got to the whole purpose of this is to bend the minds of the masses. So you've got all sorts of follow-on stuff, including people who claim to be critics of what's going on. They will already be in place in order to frustrate the genuine investigations.
That's right.
So look at somebody who am I talking about now? Shouty man from the United States,
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones. Yeah. Okay. So, of course, he became the spokesperson. He took over the role because basically he's a millionaire. He's got loads of resources behind him, you know. Yeah. And of course, he then turns out to be very pro-Israel and thinks the Muslims should be murdered and so on and so forth.
Pro-Trump.
Yeah. Now, in other words, the people behind this didn't just blow up the Twin Towers, did they? They got a whole strategy behind it.
Yeah, I can remember the 1990s first seeing, I think it was called InfoWars and Prison Planet pop up on the internet and thinking, my God, this is a professional operation here.
Yeah,
that's interesting. They even was that's suspicious, isn't it, start off from nowhere like that?
Yeah, well, the Revolutionary Communist Party in this country, who, you know, Munir Mirza is now, you know, Johnson's brain, apparently. But I remember going to a conference where they were pushing their stuff. And I remember talking to somebody about it and saying, well, look, it's so well produced, this, isn't it? Look at the production values. Where do they get the money from?
Full colour printing in those days.
You know what? It was the same printing design as the big tobacco companies used to use for their promotional material.
Anyway, so I was discussing that. And then this American guy came past. He was an American graduate student. And God knows what he's supposed to know about the Revolutionary Communist Party. I said, they get it all done in Gray's Inn Road, very cheap price. I thought, why do you know anything about that?
Well, Annie Machon, who used to work for MI5, I don't know if you had her on the show, but she's now a dissident. She says, I asked her, you know, about their infiltration, and she said, well, yeah, we infiltrated pretty much everybody. One thing we did was to try and create splits. But we found that these people were so argumentative that mostly they created their own splits without any help from us. And I said, well, who's to who? And she said, well, the only one we could never penetrate that we concluded was run by professionals was the Workers' Revolutionary Party.
Yeah.
How interesting. Yeah. And isn't it interesting? One of the top people in the Workers'
Not the Revolutionary Communist Party. Let's not mix them up.
Okay, yeah.
The RCP, Living Marxism, they were a front. And a lot of their people have ended up working for right-wing think tanks.
Do you know what? One of the bosses of Living Marxism right now heads something called the Science Media Centre, funded by Bill Gates, which has got the mobile numbers of every health correspondent in the country and is feeding them stuff right now about the vaccines, etc., etc. So that's that's the X, and I think it's SourceWatch online, I was looking at the other week, says that she was responsible for saying that an apologist for the Rwanda genocide too. So I can't remember her name, but anyway. So okay. So when is this new ebook out then?
It'll be out roughly September the 11th this year.
It's got to be before a bit, surely.
A little bit before. Well, I've got various plans for publicising it. I'm afraid they have to remain confidential at the moment. I'm paranoid.
You're not flying
enough.
Any planes into anything, are you?
Paper planes, maybe.
Okay, that sounds all good. That's
the paper
better.
Trail.
E-planes.
Into the post office tower. Watch out, post office tower. Okay, so, and how much is it? Because we have to talk about money from time to time on here. Do you know?
I'm so blissfully uninterested in money that I don't actually know what they're going to be charging for it. Okay. I know I've done a couple of weeks' work, very intense work, updating it. Let's see if there's anything else that we haven't mentioned briefly.
Go on then, your last bite of the cherry, go for it.
The last bite of the cherry is, I think, the case against the Saudis.
I know
the Saudis probably were not the masterminds of this. You know, nobody's saying they were. Well, I'm not saying they were. But, you know, if you follow Richard Clarke, who's a very important whistleblower, the CIA were manipulating the Saudis. So if the Saudis can be nailed, which now they're a little bit closer to being nailed than they ever were due to these court activities in New York, which we haven't got time to go into the detail of. But they, you know, we're then going to have Richard Clarke saying, well, the CIA did it, deliberately or not. He's not saying they deliberately meant to murder all those people, but he does think that they caused it indirectly. And then you're going to have, you know, the Saudi case, hopefully tightening up on the Saudis. And who knows? When somebody's time decides it's in their interest, no doubt we'll be told the truth about it. Trump thought it was in his interest, but then he seemed to change his mind, didn't he?
Well, somebody had a word with him, no doubt.
Started off as a 9/11
truther. Do you think, Martin,
there.
Do you think this will ever come out in more of a definitive way? Do you think the Russians, the Chinese will
I think what will happen,
tell the world what they know?
If we get up into a shooting war as a result of all of this, then the people on the receiving end, you can see that I'm pretty certain that the Russian and Chinese general staff know everything we know and loads more.
I mean, we're not going to get to a shooting war. The idea is to use the threat of a shooting war to intimidate, etc., but not to actually get there, because they know they'd lose the Western, countries.
But it may be, but this is projecting into the future, so we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I think when we first started critiquing it 20 years ago, we really were, you know, a minority of voices in the wilderness. I think because of what's happened subsequently, first the Russians and then the Chinese have woken up. They've realised that this is directed at them.
Yeah.
And that's at the early stages, even they were kind of a bit foxed by it. Like Putin even paid for a memorial to the dead in New York. It's there. He paid for it.
Oh, didn't
he? Yeah, he did, yeah. Not many people know that.
Well, we had a clip on this show a few weeks ago, the RT interview from, I think it was 2010, with Julian Assange. Got to bring him up on subjects like this because, you know, he's one of those people that has been publishing a lot of information, leaks, etc., to do with all sorts of, mostly actually to do with the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, but certainly, you know, information on some of the perpetrators. And I noticed that it was his 50th birthday in jail, and various people were giving him announcements, none of which, of course, were broadcast on the BBC. So let's hear now from one of the people that gave him birthday wishes.
Why
Yanis
are you
Varoufakis?
Julian Assange, Boris Johnson, Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, the great and the good, tyrants, tinpot dictators, and democratically elected leaders seem to be scared of Julian Assange. The question is why? Well, we know why, don't we? Through WikiLeaks, Julian succeeded in terrorizing Big Brother. He took Big Brother's technologies, constructed a digital mirror out of them, a huge one, and turned it towards the face of Big Brother. So we, who are being watched by Big Brother, can watch Big Brother watching us. Nothing terrifies Big Brother more than that. The beauty of WikiLeaks is that it operates like a global letterbox. where any whistleblower can post and place within it information that concerns all of us. WikiLeaks checks it out. They don't even know who it was that deposited that information. This is how they guarantee that no one can find out if they don't know themselves, and then allows us to know what Big Brother, big business, the big states are doing on our behalf, behind our backs, supposedly in order to keep us safe while procuring the greatest insecurity and committing the worst crimes against humanity. This is why you are killing slowly, intentionally, in a premeditated criminal fashion, Julian Assange's body every day in Britain's Guantanamo, in Belmarsh. This is why we are looking at you in the eye, in the same way that WikiLeaks has allowed us to look at Big Brother's eye. And we are telling you in no uncertain terms. You stand accused of criminality and of murdering a man that made it possible for the rest of us to know your crimes. We shall not rest until those who perpetrate the crimes and those who cover up for them, like President Biden, President Macron, Mrs. Angela Merkel, Mr. Boris Johnson, the rest of those of you in supposed authority, are held into account. Meanwhile, with a smile on our face, we wish Julian Assange a very happy birthday. Carpe diem.
So that's the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis making it absolutely clear. In a way, Martin, one of the most interesting little phrases he uses there is in your so-called authority, in your so-called positions of power. What he's suggesting there is that by their actions, many of our leaders are just discrediting themselves.
Well, they are. I mean, it's a kind of political rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, the horrible truth is that they are still very much in power, and Julian Assange is still very much in prison.
Well, I know. I'm not so sure they are, because what happens to power when people abuse it is that the foot soldiers, if you want, within the civil service, the government, the media, etc., many of them will just stop cooperating. I mean, this is one of the things we saw, for example, under the Blair government, him ordering 40 commando in Somerset, for example, over to Afghanistan, and them just refusing to go.
Well, it's possible that people will rebel, and we should always be struggling. I mean, Varoufakis is very clear about that. But, you know, you can't presume that you're going to win, or that the other side are stupid, or that they haven't got resources to deploy. They have. That doesn't mean that, I often say, they are far more wicked than ordinary folk realise, and that's the bad news. The good news is they are defeatable, but not just by talking.
And Kumbaya, singing Kumbaya is your famous little thing. Well, we're not going to get anywhere by singing Kumbaya. Well, nothing to stop him. Anyway, what do you make of the whole phenomenon of Julian Assange?
Crikey. Well, coming from the 9/11 direction, you know, a lot of people attacked him because he wouldn't say 9/11 was an inside job. But I can see reasons why he wouldn't want to say that, you know. If it's going to... He wouldn't have got Yanis Varoufakis giving a speech on his behalf, probably, if he had, you know. There comes a point when you have to balance up telling all as much of the truth as you possibly can, you know, and judiciously perhaps not telling all of it, or, you know, it's an awful thing to say, but...
In that Laura, I can't remember her surname, interview on RT that she did, the exclusive they did with Julian Assange back in whenever it was, around about 2010, she asked him a terrific question. Who do you think is your main enemy? And he depersonalises it. He says, our enemy is ignorance.
Mm.
Our main enemy is ignorance. Mm. And one of the things he said he's learnt over the previous decade doing WikiLeaks is that every single war was perpetrated through deception.
Mm.
And that the mass media went along with that deception.
Yeah.
And that was the main thing he was saying that his enemy was. I think it was a great thing to say. Martin, that's probably, you know, something you'd echo.
I agree with that. And, of course, the other thing is, what he's done is if people came to me with evidence about 9/11, then I might pursue it. But they didn't, and that's not what I'm, you know... That's, you know, it's not a he's saying I'm not a politician, I'm a journalist. I deal with the stuff that I've got to deal with. And, of course, he was very scrupulous about what he did with it as well. He didn't just spread it around all over the place.
No, he was very careful, yeah.
So, in other words, he's basically pulled his punches. I mean, at one stage, he was being accused of getting secret agents killed. And it was actually the Guardian that he'd been cooperating with who'd released the names of people. He'd wanted to keep the names out, and he wasn't allowed to edit his own material. And of course, that was part of discrediting him. So the people who were cooperating with him at The Guardian then did exactly what he's accused of doing, which is spreading these names around,
yeah.
which he didn't do.
Okay, so on
to some more parochial stuff. I mean, but what's the title of the book, before we finish?
9/11, The New Evidence.
Okay, and it's out, we're not sure when.
It's there as a book on Amazon, has been for 15 years, but the new one, as we've been discussing, has been thoroughly updated, and I've written a 3,000-word overview, summary, afterword.
The New Evidence.
Yeah, The New Evidence.
Okay, so some local news, and this is something from last week, which is, I mean, we'll have a little discussion in a minute about the whole plight of the travellers under the Priti Patel Police Crime Public Order. No, it's a court and sentencing bill, which is looks now to be running into the recess, so it'll be a month or so time for people to actually organise campaigning. Of course, it's gone right the way through the Commons. It's only in the Lords now before it receives royal assent, and it looks as if that will be in September now. So a little bit of time. But it's a very important bill because it will criminalise something like 10,000 or so gypsies and travellers around the country. And it's absolutely incredible to think that in the 21st century, in modern Britain, that travellers are going to be classed as criminals, with the police seizing their vehicles, putting them and their children in prison, making them homeless, and this sort of thing. And I don't think it's going to be happening without some resistance. And the most shocking thing, I suppose, about the bill generally is that even the police, when they were surveyed, said, well, we don't think it's necessary. The current existing law is fine. And this is police from right across the country. It says a whole range of, they surveyed, I think it was Friends, Families and Travellers, one of the traveller groups, surveyed chief constables from right across the country. And they said, well, we don't need this. It's really all down to Boris Johnson and Priti Patel. They're the only two people in the country, plus, of course, the media that sort of cheerlead these people. The mass media, anyway, that seem to be going for it. So let's have a little listen now to the Downs Committee, looking at that. We've got a so-called problem here, which is because the City Council here in Bristol don't really bother housing people hardly at all now. They've got a system, but there's no very, very few new houses coming on stream. So any new homeless people don't really get dealt with for many, many months. And so what a lot of people have decided to do is to buy vehicles, to live in those vehicles, because they can't afford to pay the rent. And the benefits aren't getting paid, so they're getting evicted or whatever. So let's have a listen now to the Downs Committee, and this is where many of the travellers in vehicles have been staying, on a place called Parry's Lane. And the glorious City Council has decided, well, why don't we just close Parry's Lane and turn it back into grass, and then they won't be able to park there.
I have been approached by the Mayor's Office. Respect the Downs are a campaign group concerned about the issues of vehicle encampments. They asked the Mayor's Office what plans it had to deal with the issues of vehicle encampments, and this was towards the end of last year. The Mayor's Office came back and suggested a couple of options, some of which we've discussed in Downs Committee meetings before. One was reviewing parking restrictions to make them easier to enforce, and one was the potential of closing the section of Parry's Lane that cuts off the corner of the White Tree roundabout, where the majority of those vehicles currently are. Respect the Downs, as a campaign group, polled their members, found that there was support for both of those options, and went back to the Mayor's Office saying, yes, we support these options. Now, the Mayor's Office, but what they're asking for is an in principle statement that if they were to close that section of road, subject to seeing a detailed plan and costings and subject to proper public consultation, would the Downs Committee be willing in principle to accept a new bit of green coming back into the Downs and ceasing to be a road? So that's the question before us.
Well, can I just ask you, so have you been able to go back to the Mayor's Office and ask if there can be an alternative site provided for the people who are living there? Because I think, you know, you and I have discussed this before and decided that would be an ideal solution.
Yes, I have. And so that was in the position paper that you and I worked on from this to the Mayor's Office. They've had that. I have had those conversations, actually. I met with the team from the Mayor's Office last week when they came to me with this request, and I did have that conversation with them as well. So yes, I have had those conversations, and I'm sure many of us will have done in different ways. I'm just I don't want to minimise that or take those issues away. I'm just trying to say that's not, you know, the question they've asked us today is, would you take this piece of land if it was no longer in vogue? And I think we just need to focus on what is for us as the Downs Committee and what is for each of us individually as elected councillors as a bigger city issue.
But if you segregate them, then I wouldn't support it.
So I think the sense that I'm getting is that in terms of accepting that piece of land, subject to Paula's point about the taking account of the wider issues that go around this as well, that subject to seeing a detailed funded plan, there's no particular objection here to that piece of land, should it ever happen, becoming part of the Downs again. I'm seeing nodding heads. Okay, thank you. I will feed that back to the Mayor's office with your... I suspect they're probably watching this on YouTube anyway, but just in case they're not, I will feed that back and make sure they're clear about the points you've raised, Paula, as well.
Sure, that how clear I'm making the point, because I feel very strongly about it. That, you know, if you segregate one from the other, I don't agree with it. So I'm not nodding my head and saying that we got this the piece of land only, on the proviso that an alternative site is found for people, because I just think we can't push this problem away to the rest of the city.
Yeah.
Or penalise those people.
Understood. Thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of the meeting.
So that's the new Lord Mayor, Tory Steve Smith, and my basic analysis of Bristol City Council is our Labour administration is a controlled opposition. The Tories are actually running the show. And what you've got there with Steve, of course, chairing that meeting, I think it was one of those, Carla Denyer or Paula O'Rourke, one of the Green councillors there, she has to correct the chair, because the chair is summing up as if, oh well, everyone agrees with me. No, and then she has to remind him, no, that's not what I said, is it? You know, at the end of it, we haven't got fair. To me, this is one of the things that I've seen in this country, is the chairs of various groups are almost always partisan in some way. So they've got to actually fairly represent what's going on around the table, which wasn't taking place there at all. But, of course, the wider thing here, I'll ask you about this, Ian Henshaw, since you're here, because we've got quite a lot of similarities, the Brightoners and the Bristolians, haven't we?
Yeah,
you know? You've got quite a lot of travellers down that way too. How do we actually solve this for travellers? Because the councils have absolutely, seems to me, I don't know what it's like in Brighton, certainly here, adamant to provide the absolute minimum space for travellers to park. There's a site up at Avonmouth, which is in between the incinerator, the motorway, and the sewage works. And there's just not enough space there for all of them anyway, even if they wanted to live way out of town. If they've got a job in the city centre and a cycle ride, it's about an hour to get each way to get anywhere. So how do we solve this? What do you think?
I don't know. If anything, it's perhaps worse in Brighton, because we're on the edge of a national park. So we are so limited in our building. And, I mean, I don't want to sound too, you know, much like an agitator, but really it's the problem of the whole system, isn't it? You know, because the system is producing homeless people, not only, of course, in the UK, but globally. And now quite a lot of them are coming over from France, seeing as it's post-Brexit, the French don't seem to feel they owe us that many favours any longer. And they quietly, you might not hear about it here, we only get it on the South East Regional News. You know, there's hundreds coming over, you know, day after day. So there's an enormous problem. I mean, the old-fashioned social democratic way is probably the least bad way of dealing with it, which is that you subsidise the parts of the country that have got, abandoned houses because nobody can earn any money there, you know, Liverpool or wherever. Some of these towns that are voting Tory now in the northeast, you encourage jobs up there and hope that people will stay around because they've got a decent job.
Well, you're lucky being in Brighton, because Saturday week there's a mass trespass down there on the Downs, which is being organised by a group called Landscapes of Freedom. This July, a new alliance of free walkers, local and national, are organising a peaceful mass trespass on Saturday the 24th of July at 10:30 a.m. to reconnect with our local Downland. Landscapes of Freedom's a new local activist group organising with and in support of the National Right to Roam campaign, which sounds great. But anyway, I'll put a link up to that too on our show page. That's tomorrow week, taking place down at the Downs in Brighton. Might even catch me down there, you never know. If I've got the time, I'd love to go down. I'm not all that good on Saturday mornings after doing the write-up for the show, but I can try and make it anyway. But Martin, let's get back to you. What about fixing the problem with the travellers? We've got a ridiculous solution here proffered by the mayor's office, which is, I know, where the travellers are parking up on the Downs, let's just dig up the tarmac and put grass there, and then they can't park there anymore.
Well, they've got to take a more constructive attitude than that, because they're not going to go away. I mean, because of the house price situation in Bristol and, of course, the renting situation, quite a lot of people who are in work cannot afford anywhere decent to live. And an obviously logical thing to do is to have a van, or some people live in houseboats. That's another thing that people do.
And they'll squat.
Well, squatting is, as you know, much more problematic because they've made it illegal.
Well, they haven't, no. I mean, you can still squat in commercial buildings. I mean, for example, I was in court today here in Bristol looking at a specific squat here on Stokes Croft, which used to be the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Well, the council stopped funding the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, so then they had to sell the building or whatever to raise some funds to keep going. And it used to be a place where people could come in to get free legal advice. All gone. That was squatted as an art gallery, and you know, that's now gone. I mean, basically, it only lasts for. But it's housed a bunch of homeless people in the city for probably best part of 2 months.
Well, but I used to squat in London in the '80s, and in actual fact, quite a few of the places where I used to squat were turned into housing co-ops, and they were actually integrated into the system. That was a different era. All of that has gone down the drain.
You know, the other thing is, of course, that Ken Clark, back in 2012, made residential squatting illegal. So that was interesting, because you know what we've got now in this city? And I think it's fair to say this about the places that have been built, the luxury flats on the harbour side, which used to be, you know, commercial area, I suppose, shipbuilding, ship repairing, this sort of thing, is that something like... 75% of them are actually empty and never used. That they've only been bought as an investment.
Well, that's right.
That's the
problem with the whole economic model that's been pursued in Britain for the last 40 years. I mean, basically, we're building luxury flats which nobody lives in, and we're not housing people who need somewhere to live. You know,
it's not just the top end either. I mean, in our house, in my humble house in the outskirts of Hove, there's the neighbours two down. Nobody's really lived in that house for 5 or 6 years because, first of all, you know, they decide that they're going to keep it off the market because prices are going up. Then they put it on the market and somebody gets it, and then they want to they spend thousands of pounds on rebuilding the kitchen, and it stays off the market for another year while that goes on, and it just goes on and on and on.
I mean, there's a load of money involved in this. I mean, there's a whole lifestyle involved with buying property. You leave university, you pay off your debts, you buy property, you get on this property, and that is your pension plan for most people.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's been deliberately engineered that way, whereas, of course, previously, from the 1940s to the 1970s, there was a different attitude towards housing.
The obvious
housing
thing
was something that everybody had to have.
The obvious thing to do is to heavily tax second homes. I mean, it's an obvious thing to do. And then why aren't they taxed?
Well, because the second home owners are the swing voters in the constituencies that keep Tory governments in power. And that's the bottom line. And they've still got some pretty good council housing in places like Northern Ireland, because they didn't dare to try and upset the apple cart there because of the consequences would have been too horrible to contemplate.
Well, anyway, talking of consequences too horrible to contemplate, we've got the face of Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, sitting staring at me here, almost like little fangs on her smiling face, as she tries to criminalise 10,000 or so British travellers. But there's an article in Declassified UK, Priti Patel's New Threat to British Journalists by Richard Norton Taylor. So he's jumped ship at The Guardian, or else he's been elbowed, Martin. Now, Richard Norton Taylor is one of the all-time great security correspondents of the world, but yet he's not getting his articles in The Guardian anymore.
No, he isn't, and people like Luke Harding has got his article in, which is supposedly, this week, which is supposedly a verbatim account of Putin plotting to put Trump in power in the US. The Guardian's, sensitive posts have been taken over by deep state operatives, not to put too fine a point on it.
People, well, what makes you say that? About, like, I mean, surely Luke Harding is just a journalist with a different view. He's not a deep state operative.
No, he's very, he gets lots of inside info from MI6. So people used to think of the Telegraph as the house magazine, as it were, of the armed services, and to a large extent it still is. But the Guardian's foreign affairs people, and of course the security affairs people, the image of the Guardian as being a, you know, pro-liberal, the most radical newspaper you can buy, that is why they put such a lot of effort into steering what you can and can't say. So, you know, they are the gatekeepers about what is and what is not acceptable opinion for left-leaning, middle-class type people.
The UK government's little-known proposed reforms to Britain's Official Secrets Act pose far-reaching threats to the media and the public's right to know. They could land journalists and others in jail for 14 years for publishing information the government claims damages national security. So Richard Norton Taylor's a little on his byline here. Richard Norton Taylor was the Guardian's defence correspondent and security editor for 3 decades and the author of several books, including most recently The State of Secrecy. The UK's Coronavirus Act is a serious threat to our civil liberties. The police, he says, crime, sentencing and courts bill will undermine them further. Now Boris Johnson's government is taking us even more down a very dangerous slippery slope. A largely unnoticed and unreported consultation paper on changes to Britain's Official Secrets Act, drawn up by the Home Office, shows that the government is preparing far-reaching threats to the media and the public's right to know. It intends to abandon the existing distinction between spying and leaking, and between leakers, whistleblowers and journalists. Both primary and onward disclosure have the potential to cause equal amounts of harm, the paper states. This makes it clear the government wants to claim a journalist responsible for an onward disclosure, a publication in a newspaper or website, for example, would be as liable and on a par in criminal law with the primary source, such as a whistleblower in a government agency. Now, I mean, this is pretty shocking stuff, but you know what it makes me think, Martin? This is Julian Assange all over, isn't it? They're trying to, they've got Julian Assange in jail for nothing, and now they're trying to cook up a law to make him guilty.
Well, they are, yeah. I mean, there's a lot
not
of...
Not just him, obviously.
But also the other laws that they passed, giving the security services, the police and the armed forces a get-out-of-jail-free card, and they can carry out any illegal act they want. I mean, that is extraordinary. I mean, if you think about it, that is an extraordinary thing to say, that the forces of the state have a get-out-of-jail-free card. And, of course, this is the case in the United States. The Espionage Act in the United States is what Julian Assange is being extradited under. And, of course, the legal position in the US is that the Pentagon Papers, for example, were leaked by Daniel Ellsberg in the 70s, and they were basically internal documents which showed that the war in Vietnam was unwinnable, and it made a big, big impact, and they couldn't prosecute him in the end because it was the New York Times had serialised it, and they just decided that it wasn't, you know, they couldn't prosecute him, so they haven't. But we're developing into a security state, but that was always going to be the way after 9/11 and 7/7 and all the rest of it. This is the goal of the deep state, is to create a more authoritarian society, probably engaged in, you know, continued. I mean, we're sending our battleships both to the Black Sea and the South China Sea as we speak.
So that's what we're all about. A lot of London journalists know far, far more than they write about. This is almost going to formalise that, isn't it? It's going to say, well, there is a whole load of stuff that you're never, ever going to be right about, however much you know about it. You're never going to be able to publish it.
Well, that's right.
And that actually sort of ties those journalists into the security state, doesn't it? It means that their loyalty is much more to their job, to their boss, and to their contacts in the security services than it is to the readers.
Well, I would argue that is the position of the Guardian's foreign affairs team as we speak. And, you know, we've uncovered the Integrity Initiative and the, what was it called, the state... There were two organisations which were basically front organisations for the deep state, and they've got all sorts of linkages. There's all sorts of stuff being leaked on the internet about British intelligence operations, places like Lebanon, for example, where lots of taxpayers' money, British taxpayers' money, is being spent to steer a political outcome in Lebanon suitable to the Western powers, and that goes across the board. It's all over the world. We've got no money for potholes, no money for housing, but there's a huge slush fund to spend on this sort of stuff.
Anyway, Maurice Frankel, director of the Freedom of Information campaign, says the Home Office paper makes it clear the government wants to make it easier to secure convictions under the Official Secrets Act, increase penalties and abandon key provisions that now provide a public interest defence for disclosing information. Leakers and journalists could be charged with disclosing information that was merely capable of being damaged, so they could be sent to jail on a hypothesis. So this is where Priti Patel wants to go, and it's hardly surprising that she's also having a go at the Travellers. The government apparently is using and seeking every opportunity to protect itself from scrutiny. It plans to restrict the way individuals and independent bodies can challenge government decisions in the courts through judicial reviews, also adopting an increasingly hostile response to requests made under FOI, Freedom of Information Act, and hiding behind what's called government by WhatsApp, where there's no written record of any discussions or decision-making as required by the Public Records Act. So they're trying to make government decisions, having government meetings with no records either. Anyway, it's a fascinating article by Richard Norton Taylor, and it's great to see him popping up again, even if it is on the in the Daily Maverick, exposing what the Home Office have been up to here. Am I right, though, Martin? This is just another way of saying, well, you know, we've managed to get Julian Assange behind bars. Now let's create a law that makes all journalists fear being treated exactly like this. So someone will come and leak some absolutely key information. Maybe it's a horrific crime that somebody has been doing in the government, in the armed forces, or even the royal family. But you will never be able to write about it in this country.
Well, that's what they want, for sure. And of course, they're a bit freaked out by the existence of the internet. So they've got their mechanisms for trying to control that. I mean, if people knew the half of what's been going on in this country and elsewhere for years, their hair would stand on end, but they don't. And therefore, they're more manipulable. And, you know, there's a kind of a sort of backwards base of the Tory party, which is all gung ho for all of this. Some, to be fair, are more, I mean, David Davis, for example, I don't necessarily agree with most things, but he's somebody who says, well, actually, this is dangerous.
But, I mean, why have we got Richard Norton Taylor having to publish on a website in South Africa and not being able to write in a British newspaper?
Well, because it's a controlled system, Tony, and we know it's a controlled system. I mean, you know, you can come on shows like this and reach a certain audience, but you're not going to make any money at it.
It sounds to me,
or you can have a journalistic career.
It sounds to me as if we're going to be in the situation where no journalist in Britain is going to actually be able to write about what's really going on in Britain, and they'll have to go abroad to do it. And what is going on, Ian?
Well, I think one thing is, I did sociology, you know, and I'm so glad that I did, because it explains so many of the things which we struggle to understand in people's behaviour. And basically, you know, that to put it in its nutshell, people believe what they want to believe. And when it comes to the media, this isn't quite sociology, this is more political science. When it comes to the media, most of the people in the sensitive political reporting sphere of the media have an attitude that's a bit like college Trotskyists, you know, sort of utterly uninterested in truth, only interested in power plays, constantly manipulating to get their faction and themselves promoted. And, you know, it's just a bit of a laugh, as far as they're concerned, people who are interested. I remember once I was speaking to a correspondent on The Independent, and he said, and he came over as presented himself as, you know, as quite a decent guy. I think he probably was, actually. But at one point he said, well, the line on this, he said, the party line on this, and he stopped himself because he'd given away the way they all do think. You know, the party line didn't stop with the fall of communism. We now have a party line which is known as the official narrative, but it's exactly the same. Yeah. And if you challenge it, you've got to have 10 times as much evidence as somebody who's just supporting it.
So this party line is a kind of little clique, really, of London journalists that, well, not so little, actually, but they all know what they're supposed to think. I've noticed as well, for example, over the last couple of years, an increasing number of American voices are popping up on the BBC. So American BBC correspondents on the World Service, American commentators on the BBC here. And I put that down to something which I came across in the 1990s called the British American Project for the Successor Generation, which was an informal group that met every 6 months or so, which was top producers, top presenters on television and radio and newspaper correspondents from Britain and America. And the idea was they were all just there to have a nice kind of party and a chit-chat and a couple of talks from professionals in the area. Like, for example, one of the BBC bosses might give a talk to them all. One of the CBS bosses might. And, of course, what happens is they all start to get into this groupthink.
Yeah.
It's groupthink. You know, we all think the same. And anyone that doesn't think like us... and they kind of know that if they step outside that, I mean, George Orwell, amazing, really. If they step outside that, that their jobs are at stake, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, of course, you've got to have a certain kind of personality to go against that grain. If you've got children and you've got a mortgage, you've got a job to do to pay it all.
Yeah. Well, we're
going to be and if you want to challenge people, then you've got to recognise you may have to forego the... lots of things, well, including the final possibility of being bumped off if you're really serious, you know.
Okay, so we're going to be hearing from some of those sorts of personalities Martin's talking about there, people that speak their mind. They are definitely not victims of groupthink, after we've heard some music. And we're going to start with a song which was recorded back in 1971. It did rather well back in 71. I think it might even have been just an LP that he put out. Gavin Bryars was the guy. And it was based on a recording of a London tramp. But it did quite well back in 1971. Then we're going to hear another song, which is a John Peel session from a group called Consolidated. And we'll be back after the sounds.
Bye. Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously, America number one.
Chloroquine, zinc, zithromycin. Cut the curve, man, gotta cut the spread. 0.85% chance gonna kill you dead. Mask on, pinch it, mask off. Mask on, pinch it, mask off. No sir, man, hydrochloroquine. Cut the curve, man, gotta cut the spread. Don't cough, no sneezes.
That's Jesus Blood Never Failed Me with Gavin Bryars, 1971. Then we've got America Number One, which is a Peel session from 1992. And finally, Face Mask Off from Media Bear. And in the final one there, you've got they're chit-chatting about chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine. And we'll be talking about that in part two. But we're going to be getting into looking pretty much straight away at the latest developments with the scamdemic, plandemic, whatever you want to call it, and of course the opening up. But we'll start by asking our guest Ian Henshaw about that, because it's incredible, Ian. I saw you on BBC World what would it be about 18 months ago in the middle of the street telling the BBC, well, I'm not so sure what's going on here. I mean, just recount, because you had living next door to you was supposedly the first super spreader in Britain. So first of all, who was this person, and well, you know, how did you know that they were a super spreader?
Well, I would never have known. All we knew was that a Hove businessman had been put into solitary confinement or whatever they call it. And then, you know, some people started turning up on the street, and I thought at first that maybe he got some debts and these people were debt collectors. They had that sort of air of sort of not very friendly. And we soon came to realize they were actually journalists after Steve, because he was this, what they were calling a super spreader.
So was he actually there in the house? Or?
At the time, he wasn't. He was sort of being hidden. I mean, it was all like...
Where had he come back from into the UK?
He'd picked it up in a conference in Singapore, and then he'd gone skiing on his way back to save on plane fares.
Or was that like in Switzerland or somewhere?
Austria, you know? I think.
Austria, okay. Yeah. So he was like the guy in the opening credits of the 1970s Survivors, who's having his... You know, he's getting sniffling and having his passport stamped all around the world, spreading this stuff everywhere he goes.
Well, that was the sort of...
Is that,
you know,
was it actually the case, though? Do we know?
You know, Tony, I don't know much about... I mean, I've been on national TV opining, as you heard, about that our neighbour, what a nice guy he was, how considerate. I just saw him as protecting a neighbour, you know. I didn't really think about it any more than that. At the time, because, you know, we all knew it wasn't any worse than flu. I mean, I've since changed my opinion somewhat, actually, on it, I have to say.
Well, go on. Okay, so how have you, you know, so you're saying it's not worse than flu, and there are, you know, there's quite a lot of evidence to say, actually, that the number of deaths has been exaggerated, as we're hearing in a minute, largely because of the pressure to put it on people's death certificates. I mean, we've had Ian Robinson on this program, who actually got an inquest into his mother's death here in Bristol, and then got the COVID removed from the death certificate. That was the only way he could do it. I had to go through an inquest in order to say, well, actually, that my mother did not die in any way of COVID. So there's been pressure to put that on the death certificates when it isn't really the case. And also, of course, if you're getting PCR tested, you could have had COVID and recovered from it months and months before, but it was still coming up as positive on the PCR test. So there is definitely some evidence that it may not be worse.
Murky.
But anyway, so what is it that's persuaded you that actually maybe is it's not just like a dangerous flu?
Yeah, it's the speed of it's purely and only down to the speed of transmission. The problem is, if you take the lid off, I'm sorry to sound like the official story here, but and please, you know, I'm not really
an
expert
on
this.
We want your view.
I do know somebody who's very senior in the who was very senior in the Department of Health, who gave me an interesting insight. No, but what I did get from that.
Name isn't Matt Hancock.
What I did get from, and this is a civil servant, what I did get from that is that they were never going to, and this is, you know, this supports the COVID skeptic position, was that they never thought about any treatments other than vaccines. From day one, it was vaccines, vaccines, and vaccines. And therefore, you've got this outrageous attacks on hydrochloroquine.
Well, you know what that means is it means there is no treatment. You know, so they've blocked any possibility of treatment, even if treatment might exist.
Well, it,
so they're saying to you,
does.
Well, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. And if you end up in hospital on a ventilator, tough.
Yeah.
You know, actually, of course, this has led to the deaths of many thousands of people, almost certainly. But anyway, look, everything's starting to lighten up now. I mean, it's almost like the Eye of Sauron is starting to get angry or crying or something because, they seem to hate the idea.
Mm.
That everything is going to get back to normal on Monday. Of course, it won't be completely back to normal, but that is the glorious 19th of July, when finally Britain will be allowed to return to normal, apparently, according to our great leader.
This pandemic is not over. This disease, coronavirus, continues to carry risks for you and your family. We cannot simply revert instantly from Monday the 19th of July to life as it was before COVID. We will stick to our plan to lift legal restrictions and to lift social distancing. But we expect and recommend that people wear a face covering in crowded and enclosed spaces where you come into contact with those you don't normally meet, such as on public transport. We're removing the government instruction to work from home where you can, but we don't expect that the whole country will return to their desks as one from Monday. And we're setting out guidance for business for a gradual return to work over the summer. And as a matter of social responsibility, we're urging nightclubs and other venues with large crowds to make use of the NHS COVID pass, which shows proof of vaccination, a recent negative test, or natural immunity as a means of entry. We're updating our guidance for the clinically extremely vulnerable on how they can keep themselves safe, and I generally urge everyone to keep thinking of others and to consider the risks. We'll keep our tough border policy, including quarantine for those arriving from red list countries, and we will keep the test, trace, and isolate system in place. Every week that goes by, we're getting hundreds of thousands more jabs into arms, and our delay to the roadmap that we announced last month has enabled us to get 7 million more jabs in the last 4 weeks alone. By next Monday, two-thirds of adults will have received a second dose, and every adult will have been offered a first dose. And it is the single most crucial thing now that you get that jab. A jab that can protect you and your family and allow you, for instance, to go on holiday. And it is, of course, only thanks to the vaccine program that we are able to take these cautious steps now. But to take these steps, we must be cautious and we must be vaccinated. So please, get that jab.
Well, that's what Boris Johnson says, get that jab. But he doesn't say anything about, well, only get that jab if you're likely to get ill through COVID-19. He doesn't say get that jab, but not if you've already had COVID-19. And we'll be hearing from Dr. Stanley Laham, the retired immunologist from Florida, about why that is such horrendous admission to make. Because what Stanley's saying is that you certainly don't need any kind of jab, and it could be far worse if you do get a jab if you've already had COVID. But none of that medical advice is coming from the chief scientific advisors, these revolving door chaps with Big Pharma that are making many of these decisions on groups like Sage, etc. I haven't had a jab. What about you, Ian and Martin?
Well, I have, out of just a general feeling of conformity, and basically, you know, I didn't see it as that high risk for me, either the risk of getting COVID or the risk from a jab. You know, I'm afraid I'm one of those slightly self-righteous people who think that if you keep fit and eat the right things, you've got a much better chance of with these things than you know, going the medical route if you can avoid it.
Yeah, okay, but this is a human experiment, isn't it? We really don't know about the long-term effects of any of these.
I don't think there's any doubt that if it hadn't been for the COVID pandemic, these vaccines, they'd have been testing them for 5 years and probably refused to use them. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any denying that.
Are you happy to take part in a human test?
Not particularly, no. But now that
well,
it's
surely
there,
you are if you've had this. I mean, you've decided, haven't you? You've just gone, right, well...
If I decide not to, then lots of people who know me are going to be, I mean, I'm admit this, you know, are going to be upset. They're going to think that I pose a risk to their health. Mm. And they probably might not want me around in their place again for the time being.
So there's a lot of social pressure around this. I know, Martin, you've had a jab, haven't you?
You've had two.
Your double jab. Now, looking at the money involved here, of course, there's 7 billion people that apparently are supposed to be, they want to get a jab every year. Looking at that in terms of cost, now this is suddenly a £200 billion annual industry that sprung up overnight, almost out of nowhere. But Martin, what about your decisions about having the jab? Why did you decide to have it, and have you had any regrets about it? Because of course you can't de-inject it, can you?
Well, on the balance of risk, I recognise that it's an experiment. I recognise the situation, but as you know, Tony, I think it's a biological warfare attack on China, which has misfired. So it's clearly a dangerous virus because it's possibly been modified in the laboratory to be dangerous in terms of wrecking the economy. And the solution is, of course, to have a proper lockdown like in China, otherwise you've got to vaccinate everybody. And that's where Boris Johnson's coming from.
Well, you say lockdown, I say ivermectin.
Well, I think if when you don't know what you're dealing with, you just use the basic stuff.
Well, if you
get it right, then you, and I saw some countries in Southeast Asia in particular have got it right. Their economies are going to do very well now.
Haiti has got it right apparently by doing almost nothing.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that in a moment, won't we? We'll discuss
anyway, I think we'd start off today by having a listen to Mike Yardley, who's a former army officer, and he was on talk radio earlier this week, not sure which day, but I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the full interview with Mike, and he was appearing on talk radio, but here he says he doesn't believe that, as I was really echoing earlier on. We're going to have three clips from him, and culminating in his talking about this as a psychological warfare operation. That's what he believes it is. But to begin with, we're going to be hearing from him talking about why he believes the death figures and the testing have not been properly interrogated by British journalists.
Why have journalists stopped being journalists? I mean, you know, we're there to discover truth, to entertain people too, to keep people informed. But certainly the BBC and the other mainstream networks have forgotten their fundamental duty as journalists. Mm. I mean, for example, the death figures, the mortality figures for COVID, which were clearly vastly inflated because these weren't all people who died because of the illness. These were people who died with it and within 28 days of testing. And then the sort of multiple, the mammoths in the living room of things like the Build Back Better campaign, which you see being mouthed by 50 or 100 different politicians all around the world at the same time, that politicians are weaving into their speeches. But who writes the script? Who wrote that Build Back Better script? And why aren't journalists exploring it and talking about it? Because it's pretty weird. I mean, you know, with all the Orwellians and strange stuff that's happening to us, that is perhaps one of the weirdest things. I'm also deeply concerned about the mortality figures, the overall, you know, 130,000 or whatever it is at the moment, mortality figure for COVID, because I'm quite sure that's inaccurate. And I think government policy has been based on inaccurate assessments of, you know, these people who've suffered or died. Inaccurate testing, and testing, when I speak to the specialists, it's not necessarily that the tests themselves are bad, it's that they're being used in the wrong way and that the thresholds are being set in the wrong place. So yes, this is all very worrying stuff, but I just want more people. We're having this conversation. These sort of conversations don't happen very often.
So this is Mark Yardley. He's The reason that he's got really incensed about this is he actually had the AstraZeneca jab and then had blood clots. And he tells here the tale of absolute uphill struggle that he got to have anything done about it. So it's all very well them saying, get the jab, get the jab, get the jab. But what when then, you know, you start getting really sick because of the jab?
There does seem to be something different about the COVID vaccine and its effects, and indeed COVID's effects on people's systems, because the sort of blood clots that are being seen begin as micro blood clots. This is not like a conventional blood clot, but the doctors at the moment, if you go along as a victim of AstraZeneca, they will treat you with anticoagulants. They'll probably give you a Doppler scan and then treat you with anticoagulants. But what they're ignoring at the moment, and I've had experience of this myself this morning, they will ignore the broader picture, the systemic picture, possibly the fact that your immune system is reacting in the wrong way to the vaccine. And basically, I was told by my GP this morning that there's nothing, you know, more. He spent a lot of time on this, and there's not really much more that he can do. But if I ask him to refer, I ask him for a referral to another specialist, he'll do that. But this is all very time consuming, and he's got lots of other patients. And I've had many similar messages from people around the country saying they are having the greatest difficulty getting treated. I had to get my MP, Pritian Patel, involved twice. First to see a GP after I failed to get through to the GP, having called the surgery 99 times, which is insane. And then I couldn't get, having, you know, been given a consultant's appointment, I couldn't actually make that happen without Priti Patel's intervention again. And it did happen, which was great. That was with a hematologist, a blood specialist. And he has now referred me on to a vascular surgeon. And beyond that, I'm hoping I can see someone about what has happened to my immune system. Because as I write to you now, I'm feeling a bit odd. I mean, I'm okay. I'm trying to do everything I can to live a healthy life. But I've got a burning sensation in my legs. I've got burning like sunburn on my forearm. It feels like sunburn. Stinging in my wrists, stinging in my knees. All of this coming on after the vaccine. Meantime, as you do, you read around the subject. And I'm fascinated to see a lot of people come to me who have specialist expertise. And I had somebody get in touch the other day who was a PCR specialist. And they said, you know, we've been talking about these apps pinging too much and causing people unnecessarily to lose work. But what's also happening is the PCR tests that we've got are not being well used in the case of the general public. Now, it all depends on where you set the threshold. And this person was an academic, you know, working in a laboratory and advising officially on this subject. And they were saying, well, it's basically this. If you get COVID, you're infectious for 2 to 4 days. And then usefully, a PCR test can then detect that period of infection, which the serious period lasts about 5 days. The problem is after that, a PCR test may be picking up false positives for up to about 80 days. Now, in the case of testing the general public, no allowance for that is made. In the case of testing NHS staff members, an allowance is made so they can continue working even though they may have tested positive, depending on the other information that they have to hand. So the bottom line of it is this. There are a vast number of cases which are actually false cases, and that is distorting our nation. It's costing us billions of pounds, probably, and it's also giving people completely the wrong idea by how many people who are actually seriously affected in a life-threatening way, or indeed just seriously infected.
So that's a former army officer, Mike Yardley, there. Martin, I mean, he's really saying, I suppose, you know, something you won't really like to hear. That is that the PCR test is vastly exaggerating. I mean, if they're picking up as if it's a live infection, on a positive test 80 days after actually the infection's gone, or maybe 75 days after the infection's gone and you're not transmissible anymore, of course it's going to pick up a lot more people than, say, for example, a lateral flow test, which is apparently less false positives involved in that test. So the testing could be coming up with a whole load of cases of people that actually aren't infectious at all.
Yeah, and the other thing that might be happening, because Dido Harding is running the testing regime at a cost of tens of billions.
Bilderberger, by the way.
Yeah, well, we haven't actually got an effective test and trace regime in this country. So there's lots and lots of people out there who haven't been tested who are quite likely positive. And, of course, that then increases the numbers because we haven't tested enough people to find out.
Yeah, the other thing about Mike, Ian, is that he's a very, very dogged chap, obviously. You know, he's got ill from the vaccine. He's had to fight tooth and nail to actually even get to see a doctor.
Well, our mutual friend at the BBC, if she wasn't from a professional journalist, I wouldn't mention something third hand, but she knows somebody who has actually died. And the reason they died was because the paramedics who came to attend them when they had blood clots couldn't believe that it had come from the vaccine. So they basically just told her they had nothing to worry about. And then they were dead a few days later. Blood clots.
Oh, that's horrendous. Anyway, yeah. Mike is saying is that, the mass media is absolutely complicit, as I say, at the beginning, at the end of this show every week. They're collaborators. He's saying that language has been twisted and also that there's a psychological operation going on here. And he should know. He's done psychology and he's been an army officer too.
Many people in positions of power at the moment use the word pandemic. There is no pandemic at the moment. By any accepted medical or academic definition, there is not a pandemic on at the moment. You could even have an argument about whether there has been, but there is definitely no pandemic going on now, although many people in positions of authority do continue to use that word promiscuously and wrongly, and giving the public a false impression, and of course making a lot of people fearful. Now, in my old academic background, I was a psychologist. I then went into the army, but I am very concerned about the sort of general psyop that sage experts seem to be organizing and advising on for the government. And it goes beyond that. It's not just sage. The government have deployed what are nothing less than psyops against the British people, many of whom, particularly elderly people, and I've observed this literally because I'm interested in it, are suffering from the effects of that and are showing signs of anxiety and depression and other mental illness as a result of being targeted by government psyops. Now, that really does bother me. That is a real deal, very disturbing. And when people start saying things like pandemic this and pandemic that, they are only increasing the damage and anxiety to those people who at the moment, you still see them shuffling along the road, wearing masks, looking terrified. Those people have been damaged. And people who are using language like that, probably deliberately, to continue making people fearful, to continue people cooperating with what many regard as a totalitarian agenda. I think that's a really bad thing.
So what do you make of that, Martin? I was actually in the city centre here today and saw exactly the sort of woman he's talking about there. An elderly lady, maybe in her late 70s, early 80s, pushing a shopping trolley with a mask on, her face down, looking very fearful. In the open air, she feels that she has to wear a mask out in the open air. Now, there's obviously, quite a powerful fear factor here.
Well, there is, because as I've said to you before, and I say every week on this show, I think this is a biological warfare agent. And of course, the PSYOP is part of it, but also it's a dangerous virus in the first place,
which is why the Chinese had a massive lockdown. How much is this lady I saw today?
And then got on top of it.
How much is this lady I saw today really in danger? Does she really need to wear a mask outside?
Well, she's doing what Boris Johnson recommended earlier, which is exercising her personal judgment about it. On the basis of the information she has got.
Judgment is based on a PSYOP.
Well, it may well be based on a PSYOP. The whole PSYOP is not just a PSYOP, psychological warfare man. It's also a biological warfare agent, because we're going to cover later on, no doubt, that it possibly a leak from the Wuhan Virology Lab, funded by the Pentagon. And of course, it's now becoming quite obvious, because as I say every week, the Israeli Defense Forces were given a heads up in November 2019, just after the markets collapsed in September 2019. Nobody's talking about that.
Well, the market didn't collapse.
No, it did. Well, it didn't collapse, because what happened is that the BlackRock took everything over, but they needed an excuse for what they were doing, and then COVID came along.
Actually, we're going to be hearing about
BlackRock. Yes, well, indeed. So, in other words, it's not just a psychological warfare, it's also warfare.
We're going to be hearing about BlackRock later, actually, and this other organisation, Vanguard, which owns so much of what we see in here, and in a way, that is one of the most fascinating explanations of what's going on. But what do you make of what he was saying there, Ian, about he actually used the word sage psyop. He thinks that the people in Sage, who are obviously in this revolving door with the pharmaceutical industry, are running a psychological operation through the British government and the media.
Well, they're all aware of, you know, media manipulation. They're all aware of media manipulation, you know, so to that extent, yes, because that's what, in a sense, psyops are. I mean, I couldn't help thinking there is a parallel with 9/11. You know, lots of people after 9/11 thought that there was going to be a bomb going off outside their door. You know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous now to say that, but there was a huge amount of fear at the time. And terror, you know, terror is sort of almost more terrifying in the name, because it's the word terror. You know, I'd say the 9/11's a better psyop, you know.
Well, this is
cynically.
I mean, effectively, what he's saying here really is that this former army officer is that this is a state terrorist operation against the British people in this country elsewhere.
All I can say to that is, diddums. What do you think he was doing when he was employed by the army? He was probably...
He would be running these sort of operations against people like the Libyans, etc.
Before
the takeover of Libya.
And the idea that it's not been used on the British people. We've been under the cost of psychological warfare operations all my life.
Just,
I'm 61
years old.
Just
to be fair to him, he doesn't actually say that he was a psychological warfare officer. He just said he studied psychology and then he went into the army.
All right. Well, that might be useful to know if he was a psychological warfare officer.
He's certainly an interesting character. Another very interesting character, and this time is a doctor in the United States who was one of the top doctors in the country, and he's been talking about similar aspects of this, saying that he believes that the coronavirus, the benign common cold version of the coronavirus, is actually a transmission device. And this, I suppose, falls into line, Martin, with what you're saying about biological warfare.
Coronavirus is a naturally occurring, very benign virus that doesn't even give most people the cold, but at the most it gives you a common cold, right? Doesn't kill you, doesn't make you very sick. But what they've done is, it's the transmission device. So think about how we were years ago. When we first came into the nuclear age, we couldn't easily distribute nuclear weapons. We had to drop them from onto the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we just had to take them in a plane. But now we have, the hard part is actually the guidance missile technology. So in bioweapons, what we had is, we had a lot of bioweapons over the years. So the one I was very worried about was smallpox. But most of these bioweapons were either hard to distribute, or there was treatment for them or something. And the problem here is distribution. So here, like, you know, remember the anthrax thing? It came out in the envelopes. It went to Congress. It's hard to distribute anthrax. It might be deadly to some people, but it's hard to distribute. So let's make a missile. And the missile is coronavirus, which is a huge, highly transmissible, very small particle virus. It can't be masked away no matter what the propaganda is. You can't hide from it behind a plastic little screen that costs businesses too much money. It's just incredibly transmissible, but it's very benign. Now add to that the warhead. And the warhead is a little protein that they tacked on that attaches to your ACE2 pathway. And human beings have these ACE2 pathways that's somewhat genetically determined. And when you put on this hook, this what they call the spike protein, then it gets into these ACE2 pathways, which now is in your heart, in your lungs, in your testicle, in your brain. It can kill you. Now, I believe what happened here is that I kind of think it was let out purposely, but I can't prove that. It was either accidentally released or it was let out purposely, but whatever it happened. When it first came out, like many viruses, I believe that it was worse. The first generation was more deadly, okay? So that it came out, it did kill a lot of people in Wuhan. It did kill people in Lombardy. I tell people, you know, there's a problem when doctors are dying, and doctors and nurses in Lombardy were dying. If we can't save ourselves, we're in trouble. That's the time to go to your basement. It does help to go to your basement, but you can't then go out to have a beer or go out and go to the grocery store. That's just shutting down people's business for economic warfare. But real isolation, like against smallpox, works. So anyway, it first came out to Lombardy. It went to New York. That was probably first generation virus, and it did kill a bunch of people initially. But just like most viruses, almost all viruses that I know of, you know, as they pass through the human host, they get weaker. This is just a, you know, adaptive advantage. If you're the Napoleon of viruses and you want to take over the world, you don't want to kill every host you come across. You're not going to spread. So what you do is you become less deadly, more transmissible. And that's what this has done over time. That's my belief about the big picture here. But what happened is, as soon as this thing came out, it became, you know, it's very easy to piggyback onto things. And whether, like I say, whether if this was a planned release, then we're talking about planned warfare. If it was an accidental release, then we're talking about warfare that was piggybacked onto this accidental release. Because what they've done is they've made it, they've used it to create fear. And fear is an incredible psychological manipulator of populations. If I want to make everybody, you know, if I want to, they've taken, look at, they, like you said, they've taken down our economy. They've taken, they're taking down our generation of children with these stupid masks. They're damaging us in all sorts of ways. And it's a psyop at this point. Because here's the other thing we learned. And I don't think they, I don't really think they expected us, doctors like myself. I mean, we had nothing to do. We were shut down. We were sitting at home. And what do? Our response is to study. And we learned lots of things. In fact, I found out that we had treatment for viruses probably going back into the late 70s. And so I graduated medical school in 1980. So I'm an old fart. But my son graduated much later, just recently. And he's a general surgeon. And I asked him, I said, have you ever heard in your entire medical education, all the fellowship, all the stuff you're doing, you ever heard we could treat viruses with these antimicrobial agents? No, he never heard it. Called my friend in Florida. 40-year internal medicine professor, real medicine doctor. He said, have you ever heard that we could treat viruses with some kind of antimicrobial agent? No, he never heard that. So this is the biggest lie. I tried to publish a paper called that, but they made me change the title to something I can't remember. But it's about the fact that they've lied to us for 40 years about this treatment. So here's the big picture. If you bring out a virus like this, you don't need, when we talk about vaccines and things, why do we have vaccines? We have vaccines because we didn't have treatment for smallpox. We didn't, and it was a very deadly disease. That made sense to have a vaccine. We didn't have treatment for polio initially, so made sense to have a vaccine. But this, even without doing anything, this disease has a 99.991% chance of survival in last viral season. I'll call it a viral season because it really isn't just a flu season anymore. But, you know, in the winter season, that's what our last season, that's what our horrible, including New York and everything, that was the overall survival in the world. As opposed to a standard viral flu season, it's 99.992%. You see the big difference. So number one, it's not that all deadly. But number two, we actually have a treatment for this that works extremely well. In spite of all the propaganda and the attempts to falsify the medical literature, which they've gotten caught at, and the attempts to dismiss anything they don't agree with, we have treatment for it, and it really does work. So we don't need, and you'd say, why would they hide treatment? Well, I can come up with two reasons. One is that your $69 billion vaccine industry goes to zero if you have an effective treatment for all these viral airborne diseases, right?
Well, I'm sorry, I cut that off before his second reason, but that's Dr. Lee Merritt in the United States. Thank you very much to the listener who sent that in to me, whoever you are. Fascinating interview with this guy. He used to be head of one of the US medical doctors associations. There's so much in there, really. But Martin, he's talking there in an interesting term he's using. He's saying that the coronavirus, the common cold coronavirus, is the transmission device, but the spike protein has been inserted into it is the warhead. So he's actually talking about it almost like as a ballistic missile, a little tiny, minuscule, invisible one.
And I, you know, to cut to the chase, my current best cut of what I think has happened is that there's a biological warfare attack on China carried out in November because the stock market had collapsed in the US in September, which people have forgotten all about because they've turned the money tap on, and everybody thinks that they turned the money tap on because of COVID.
Well, there were bigger bailouts than there were in 2008.
No, the one that happened in 2019 was bigger than 2008.
Yeah.
And most people don't even realise it's happened. So you've got people, Tory voters here, who are quite happy for the government to print money because of COVID. So it gave, and the same thing happened after 9/11.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing. Because the dot-com bubble had burst. Yeah. And of course, in the capitalist rule book, you just got to go bust. But they didn't. They said, oh, because of 9/11, we'll have to print money. And then, of course, the same thing happened in 2008.
Because of our pals running these big corporations.
Yeah, so in other words, all of this is linked together. Now, I think what they intended to do by what they were doing in the Wuhan lab, and it's not necessarily the Wuhan lab that's the source of this.
No.
By funding it, it makes it possible for them to blame the Wuhan lab. But it may have come from that lab, or it may have come from the US.
Or the UK.
Well, or Porton Down.
Or it's all sorts of places.
Yes.
It could have come
and of course,
from.
The purpose of that is the timing in China was that it happened just before Chinese New Year. And don't forget, the US rhetoric against China was really ramping through the roof at that point. We've got to stop them now. They're getting too big. You remember they've arrested that woman in Canada because she was supposedly trading with the Iranians. She's still under house arrest in Vancouver. And they basically, they've got all this talk about we're going to have a trade war with China and blah, 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 blah. And then just before, the outbreak of COVID, half the Chinese pig herd died of swine flu. All of their chicken flock died of bird flu. And of course, the Chinese know that the Western powers used biological and chemical weapons in Korea. They've just saturated North Korea with them. They did the same sort of thing in Cuba. They've got a track record of using this kind
of
stuff.
But I mean, I think it's the first time I've heard anyone, certainly a doctor, using this sort of terminology that you've got the transmission device and the warhead, and that's actually COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, and you don't want it to be too deadly for the reasons he's pointed out, because if you're going to be the Napoleon of viruses, you're going to die out.
Yeah.
Whereas what this does is, can you imagine if you are the government in China trying to, what the hell are we going to do about this?
Apparently, as the virus goes on, it becomes less deadly and carries on being as transmissible. Actually, you know, if you were going to make, you and I were the sort of evil empire, you know, whatever, the Bond villains sitting down trying to do something terrible. If you wanted to have a bioweapon, of course, you would use something which was the most transmissible thing in the world, like the common cold.
Yeah.
And then you would peg your nasty little spike protein onto that. And that, of course, is all possible in these bioweapons.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, the other thing is, because it does become less potent over time, you've not burned your boats about taking over in China afterwards. Yeah? You understand me? If the Chinese economy had been crashed as a result of what happened, it wasn't, because they responded in exactly the right way. And of course, I think what's happened now is that they're like with 9/11, they intended to invade a number of countries, one after the other. But they didn't get to their final goals.
Anyway,
with China, it's not worked out the way they thought, because the Chinese economy, in fact, has now bounced back.
The other thing is, Martin, very important here is that because of Fox News' coverage, it's going to be almost impossible for them to pin it on the Chinese, because as Fox has shown, that Dr. Fauci, Peter Daszak, EcoHealth Alliance were the guys who were doing the research over in Wuhan. And that would possibly never come out, especially because Peter Daszak was the guy for the World Health Organization that was investigating himself. He's now had to leave that investigation group. But I think Fox have done a superb job on actually exposing that. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Dr. Lee Merritt second clip from him in the US. And this is his concerns about this whole gene enhancement therapy that's been going on.
That spike protein, you're actually creating the pathogen in your body. So, you know, this is where it gets a little wishy about how much of that spike protein is actually being created. And I don't know how to find that. I can't find that. But I'm sure somebody knows. What happens is the problem, and this is the problem, and I'll tell you what happened in the animal studies. There have been four different vaccines and three different animal studies that I know of. In ferrets, in cats. Cats have a natural thing with the coronavirus. So it's cats and ferrets and I think something else. They started after SARS, they did cats. And then after MERS, they did, which are all coronavirus pathogens that are more deadly. And they after MERS, they tried it in ferrets and something else. And what happened is all the animals died. It wasn't subtle, okay? But they didn't die of the vaccine. What they died from was called immune enhancement or antibody-induced enhancement or antibody-dependent enhancement. They call it ADE now, but they used to call it immune enhancement. Here's what happens. So they make the RNA, and so you're getting ready with this. You get the vaccine, and you do fine, all right? Now you challenge the animal with the virus that you're supposed to be immunizing against. So when they challenged those cats with SARS, what happened is instead of killing the virus or, you know, weakening, what they did is your this stylized immuno response that they've built into your system went out and coded the virus. So the virus came into the cat's body like a Trojan horse, unseen by the cat's own immune system. And then it replicated without checking and killed the cat with overwhelming sepsis and cardiac failure. And that happened in the ferrets. That happened every time they've tried this. And so let me just point out, we have never made it through an animal study successfully for this type of virus. We have never done this in humans before. At least we haven't. Maybe the Chinese haven't. I'll talk about that in a second. But that's why we don't really have a track record of success. This vaccine was rolled out to distribution centers before they even made a show of caring about the FDA approving it. Do you realize that? I mean, it went out to for distribution. I know in Nebraska, it was in the distribution center within days before the FDA even said they were going to approve it. What? I mean, I've never seen that happen before. And the longest they've really followed people after the vaccine is 2 months. Well, you see, that's not enough time to know that we won't have that antibody enhancement problem. And I will make this military point. This is a perfect binary weapon. There's no way I know exactly what that mRNA is programmed to, and neither do you, and neither do most doctors. The doctors can't get at that data. That's the guys at the very top of this project, okay? They know, but we don't know. They say it's to the spike protein, but how do we prove it? We don't know. So if I were China and I wanted to take down our military, that's easy. We've seen happen. I make it to something I could hook onto this coronavirus, like the spike protein or something else, another protein. And I just make an mRNA to that, but I know it doesn't exist in nature, so nobody's going to die from the vaccine. And then 2 years later, I release the whatever it is that I made. You see what I'm saying? The counterpart, and it causes this immune enhancement death. So it's a delayed death. That's what binary poisons are. They're delayed. I give you part one because then I can walk away, and then you accidentally get in contact with part two and die, and you can't trace it.
Yeah, and that's not a hypothetical threat. There was a leak of members of the Communist Chinese Party out of Shanghai, and there was hundreds of them working in Pfizer and AstraZeneca and GlaxoSmithKline, the companies that were making these vaccines. That is absolutely terrifying.
So we're going to trust them.
Yeah, right.
That they're acting in our best interest.
So Dr. Lee Merritt there, MERRIT, all sorts of interesting ideas he's giving out there, Marty, saying that actually by having a vaccine, and one of these mRNA vaccines, not only is the production of them completely secret, so none of these doctors are allowed to know what's really going on, all patented and done by these private big pharma companies. What he's saying is that the vaccine would be fairly innocuous to begin with, and it might help you. But if another one of these coronaviruses then comes along, a different sort of coronavirus, it could combine with the vaccine to kill you. You know, he's talking about a potential here for it being a binary weapon.
Okay. Well, it's sort of like a two-tap strike with an IED.
A drone, yeah. Or a drone, yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing I pick up from that is it's the Chinese doing it to us. And, of course, the unthinkable thing is that actually we were doing it to the Chinese.
But these are not Chinese companies making these vaccines, are they?
No, they're not. And so he's talking about Chinese people working for Pfizer. But in actual fact, the Chinese government has developed their own Sinopharm vaccine, not working with the West at all. And Putin was, he does this big phone-in that he does every year. And people were saying...
Press conference, basically, isn't it? Well, but open to the public.
Yeah, but it goes on for hours, so it's a big deal. And he was asked about all of this. He said, look at all the different political systems around the world which say that this virus is a threat. The Cubans think it's a threat. We think it's a threat. The Chinese think it's a threat. And, of course, you know, all of these different countries are responding to this as a threat. We are not all working together. If people think that we are working with the Americans, they are deluded. And, of course, in actual fact, I think that this is a biological warfare attack
the response has been drawn down the lines of the superpowers, hasn't it? In fact, they've each got their own main vaccines that they think are the great vaccines. And also, of course, they're putting out different messages through their mass media, too.
They are, indeed. But the point is, when people talk about Big Pharma in the West, Big Pharma is an absolute disgrace. It always has been. It still is. But, of course, Big Pharma doesn't dominate Cuba. In fact, they've been under embargo since 1959. They have to develop their own vaccines because nobody's allowed to sell them any. And they have. They've developed their own vaccines in Cuba because they've got a very, you know...
Do you want to say something about the protests in Cuba last weekend?
Well, I mean...
They've got a lot of coverage.
Yeah, well, I mean, what the Cuban government is saying is that there are obviously problems because of the they've reimposed the blockade.
So the United States had.
Yeah, so Obama lifted the blockade. Trump reimposed it. And nobody's allowed to go in or out of Cuba, or and even third parties aren't allowed to trade with them. Now, you can imagine over 50, 60 years...
Well, I think we should set up a Bristol-Cuba trade delegation.
Well, maybe so, but I mean, what could we sell them, you know? And of course, I suspect that there is an element of A, genuine discontent, especially amongst younger people, and B, it's all been orchestrated on WhatsApp and there's plenty of money being chucked at it by the US deep state. There's no doubt about that. We've got similar uprisings going on in Colombia, for example.
But
loads of people have been killed by the police, and loads of social movement activists have been murdered. Lots of FARC guerrillas who are supposedly being integrated have all been assassinated. But we're not hearing about that every day because Colombia is a good country. They're on our side.
Well, okay. So listen, Lee Merritt actually then he touched on some really interesting stuff about the animal tests of these. Okay, so SARS and MERS have been around for a while. Lots of people around the world, eminent virologists, were trying to get vaccines to these SARS and MERS, trying them out on animals in the good old-fashioned way, and finding that actually the ferrets and the cats were just dying when they gave them these viruses. And yet they're now saying, oh, well, it's okay. Sorry, vaccines. And now they're saying, oh, it's okay, we'll try them out on humans now. It's not very promising, really, is it?
I think that is such a bombshell that... You know, we should research it really carefully, because, you know, that sounds to me like somebody's just thrown a grenade into the room. You know, because what the implication is that millions and millions of people who've been vaccinated are all going to die. You know, that is the implication. Now, you know, I'd suggest, I don't feel as if I'm an expert at all on COVID, but just as a researcher...
Well, one would hope that the vaccines that have been developed from humans have learnt lessons from the deaths of the animals. Well, one would hope that they're not just doing the same thing.
No, I think he's just saying it's systematic. It's the same problem. It's going to be the same. But you know, I do think. I remember when Philip Marshall died. One of the aspects that we didn't discuss about that was how somebody popped up. I'm obviously not going to name them because it would be somewhat a bit libelous potentially. But somebody popped up who sort of replaced Philip Marshall as the sort of the expert on plane responses on 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was an air hostess, actually. And suddenly she was everywhere. You know, all the, you thought, independent alternative sites had all swallowed her hook, line and sinker. And I think she was the planned, possibly, you know, planned. And so I think, you know, the COVID thing is there are going to be people around who are plausible sounding.
This is a fascinating phenomenon you've touched on here, Ian. Thank you so much for bringing it up. The idea that somebody is doing something, a good job, which is threatening to the deep state, and so they assassinate that person, and then they've actually taken the trouble to have a kind of doppelganger almost, yeah, in a way, which they control to, yeah, take over.
Counter gangs.
Yeah. Incredible, isn't it?
Gangs,
you know what?
Counter gangs.
I would suggest, and in fact, from the Frank United Kitson. States, is the death of Bill Cooper in the United States, because he was very much an insider, and he did a radio show. He predicted 9/11. He said, well, look, this guy Bin Laden is going to be blamed for a big attack, and that was 6 weeks before the 9/11 attacks happened. Since we're talking a little bit about 9/11 tonight, he's saying, actually, what was going on there was a report from CNN on the TV in the US. Which was showing Bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan, and CNN had tracked him down. And so Bill said, well, look, this is insane. So you're telling me that the American Secret Services, the CIA, etc., cannot track this guy down, but a little CNN camera crew can. So there's obviously something. He was, you know, looking ahead and saying, there's something going on here. This guy is about to be set up as the bad guy. So anyway, Bill Cooper was doing this sort of stuff week after week, day after day, on his program, The Hour of the Time. And he was then killed by the FBI. The FBI turned up at his home to try and arrest him. And they were in disguise basically disguised as a bunch of hoodlums, apparently. And there was a shootout. Bill Cooper was shot dead. Who then popped up on the scene? Oh, actually, he was hanging around in the background. Alex Jones. A similar sort of shock jock. So we've done a little bit of an unpicking of the whole Alex Jones phenomenon this evening. Thank you very much. But look, what do you make of this whole idea of, because we've heard that these sorts of COVID SARS viruses have been, vaccines have been trialed on animals, but we haven't actually heard much about the results. There he is going into some of the details.
Yeah. No, I don't know anything about that, I'm afraid. But one thing that I noticed from the
sepsis and heart disease, he says, is one of the things that the cats died of.
Yeah.
Heart disease, again, is something which we've seen a lot of people dying after having the vaccines. I don't know how many, but certainly a lot of the people post-vaccine deaths are heart attacks.
Yeah.
And, you know, so...
I mean, all I can say is I look at the headlines of lots of skeptic COVID stuff, and I have to admit I don't go much beyond the headlines most of the time. But what I have noticed is that there's an awful lot of different arguments here. You know, there is not one line. There are people saying you shouldn't get vaccinated, but you should wear a mask to compensate. There's other people saying don't wear a mask, they're a waste of time, get vaccinated. There's theories about, you know, this, that, and the other, which is good. It's healthy in a way.
Well, we're trying to unpick some of that.
Yeah. Here.
And one of the best people I've come across in the world to do that is our very own Dr. Stanley Laham. I'm sure he won't mind us saying that, because he's an expert that's not been called on to speak in the States at all, even though he's a Florida-based retired immunologist, eminent chap. His PhD discovered a new virus, retroviridae type virus like AIDS, and an expert. He's worked his whole life at Florida University and in the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and he had some pretty strong things to say about COVID. But before that, I asked him this week in our little exclusive again with Stanley about Haiti and what he thought had happened there, because he does actually have quite a lot of patients in the Dominican Republic next door and keeps a very close eye on Haiti, actually not being that far away, based in Florida. And here he is explaining to me what his thoughts about the assassination of the Haitian president, who had banned vaccinations from his country and also had an incredibly good rate of survival of COVID and almost no people actually having COVID over in Haiti. There are various reasons for that. Possibly one is that that there was a widespread use of chloroquine against malaria there. You know, the locals sort of taking these tablets like sweets every day to stop the malaria. But then also the fact that because it's such a poor country, people have got an incredibly robust immune system. And let's anyway hear what Dr. Stanley Laham had to say this week about the assassination of the Haitian president.
One thing that I can tell you for sure is that whoever prepared this, whoever were the masterminds behind that, would not dare antagonize the United States. Because you see, Haitians live in fear of not getting their visa to come to the U.S. And this is just an hour and 45-minute trip to the U.S. from Port-au-Prince. And I can tell you, whether oligarchs or middle class in Haiti, everybody needs their visa. And the U.S. could easily, and the U.S. is feigning indignation at this assassination. Well, and they're sending the FBI, I'm sure you've heard the story, that an FBI delegation has gone to Haiti to help investigate the crime. Don't you find that this is kind of bizarre when the most important actual eyewitness to the murder is sequestered right here in Miami? This is where the FBI investigation should start. The wife actually saw who killed her husband. Why isn't she being questioned? Why is it that they're going to Haiti to question mercenaries who may or may not even know who hired them?
So that's Dr. Stanley Laham there. Martin, he's saying that it's pretty obvious the US has been involved in this, because the people who did this attack had no fear of the US.
That's pretty obvious, yeah. I mean, I agree with that.
What are the geopolitics behind this then?
Well, I mean, the guy who's assassinated had overstayed his term. You know, so in other words, resistance was beginning to build in the shanty towns in Port-au-Prince against him. And of course,
it wasn't the shanty towns that commissioned the
assassination. No, indeed. So in other words, it's not likely to be them who did this. I mean, lots of people were protesting against him because they wanted, basically, the Lavalas movement in Haiti has been repressed ever since Aristide was removed by a coup back in the noughties. And there's not been a free and fair election in Haiti since that era. And basically, the Lavalas movement has been basically boycotting the sham elections, which the oligarchy have been organising with the assistance of the United States. The most likely explanation for this is infighting within the oligarchy. And, of course, it gives an excuse for a military intervention by the US. Yeah, so the acting prime minister has called for US troops to return to Haiti. They hardly ever go. I mean, they've been in Haiti since 1915. After the assassination of the president in 1915, the US Marines went in there, and they've been dominating the politics of the country ever since.
Some bright sparks around the world have pointed out this is the third president of a country that's rejected the vaccines that's died since this all began. So the leaders of Haiti, Tanzania and Zambia, these various leaders, Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia, John Magufuli of Tanzania, and now also this chap Juvenal Moïse from Haiti. So is it feasible that, I mean, we were talking about assassinations at the beginning, weren't we? Is it feasible that if you decide that you're going to block vaccines from your country, that somebody might come and bump you off?
It's feasible, but you've got to think there are lots of other reasons why these people might be assassinated or just die. So, you know, you've got to keep some scepticism. It's all very well joining the dots, but you've got to recognise that that's speculative. We don't know what happened. We're not sure. It certainly wasn't any leftist faction, for example. These Colombian mercenaries are basically saying, we were told, you know, they've got track records of actually being involved in killing people inside Colombia.
Tanzania definitely took a very anti-vaccine stance, but in Zambia, they've only this year in March saying that they have plans to vaccinate people over the age of 18 this March. So that's a bit more recent. So, and anyway, I mean, you know, I just find it fascinating that these sort of things are not, you know, not connected. The fact that there may be.
Well, it may be so. I mean, on the internet, people certainly are connecting these things, especially if COVID is the thing that they're interested in. But I'm basically thinking there's more geopolitics than COVID. COVID is the latest iteration of geopolitical contest. It's not the only game in town. And there's other things going on. I mean, look what's happening in South Africa. Zuma's just been put in prison for corruption. Lots of Zulu disenfranchised people have gone on the rampage. The whole COVID strategy is, A, they wanted to knock down China, but that failed. And then, of course, they're going to spread catastrophe around the world so that we can have the Great Reset and all the rest
of it. Anyway, the main message that Dr. Stanley Laham, we didn't just call him to chat about Haiti, he wanted to put across was how absolutely absurd it was, he believes, to have a COVID-19 vaccine if you've already had COVID, that this can seriously interfere with the way your immune system protects your body. So let's have a listen to, it's a rather technical discussion, but for those that are interested in how the immune system works, like I am, it's absolutely fascinating as to why he is saying if you've had COVID, do not have a vaccine.
One thing that's being propagated is that everybody who has had actually who has been infected with the coronavirus that had COVID-19 should also get vaccinated because that will give them a stronger immunity. That is a fallacy. When you get vaccinated, when you get infected with the coronavirus, as I explained to you before, your body sees a whole virus and makes antibodies to various parts, various structures of the virus. The vaccines that have been developed, this mRNA technology that has been developed, only gives you a monoclonal antibody because they're taking a piece of mRNA that codes for a specific antigen in the spike protein antigen. They're injecting it into you. You're not seeing a whole virus. This mRNA is not a virus. What it does is that your cells are supposed to capture it and translate it into that protein. That's what they call going from mRNA, messenger RNA, to protein. The process is called translation. And that protein that is made intracellularly after your cells absorb that mRNA, goes to the cell membrane where it becomes visible to your immune system and you make antibodies and activate cellular immunity against that specific structure. The antibodies you make are called monoclonal antibodies. They are specific for that product, the protein product, which is one protein, the protein product of that mRNA. Now, the person who got infected with the virus, on the other hand, does that same antibody plus others to other parts of the virus, to many other parts of the virus. So that person is much better prepared to fight off any new variant than the person who was vaccinated. Because the person who was vaccinated, if the mutation that caused that new variant is that exact protein that this mRNA vaccine coded for, then he will have much less protection than the person who is actually naturally vaccinated with the virus and has about 7 to 8 different type of antibodies to 7 to 8 different structures of the virus. I want to point out another advantage. The person who was infected, who had actually had COVID-19, did something else. He produced interferon. That interferon is something that your cells produce that goes and tells other cells that there's a virus around, and they make a protein that protects them against absorption with that virus. So the person who had COVID-19 actually produced interferon for that COVID-19. The person who was vaccinated with mRNA does not. So that's another layer of protection that the person with who was naturally infected has over the person who was vaccinated. So to tell people who had COVID-19, oh yes, go get that mRNA vaccine, is to me an absurdity.
What's the effect then if you have this kind of double immunity? That's what most people believe, that you've got some sort of natural immunity, but you've also got that boosted by having the vaccine too.
that is baloney. What it's going to do, yes, it's going to make you, it's going to boost only one thing, that specific monoclonal antibody, only the B cells that are specifically targeted that single protein. But at the same time, you risk an autoimmune response to a much greater degree than the person who had not had COVID-19. And I just had a case of somebody who had COVID-19, who was hospitalized. They thought he was having a heart attack. What he was getting is pericarditis due to an inflammatory response from the vaccine, and having water, leakage of fluid into his pericardium. And if you want to hear the whole story, that person had already had a heart attack, and his insurance did not cover. He had insurance for everything, excluding heart attacks, heart events. So I had advised them to not report this as a heart event, but as an inflammatory response to the vaccine, which the insurance company accepted as an explanation and paid the hospital. He was 5 days in hospital and fluid was taken out of his pericardium.
Well, I'm not quite sure what a pericardium is. I think it's pretty close to the heart. But it's incredible. I mean, I love hearing from Stanley, because he also paints this incredible picture, Martin, of the situation in the United States where, if he was to report this as a heart attack, then he would not get paid. His insurance, his hospital bills would be unpaid by his insurance. And Stanley said, I advise you to report this as something different a little bit, and then you'll be fine and your insurance will pay for you. We haven't got that problem here, thank God.
Well, we're going to get it. That's the plan.
This new bill
to change the health service, which has been brought in. I mean, people in the health service are screaming, look, we don't need any change at the moment, thank you very much. Let's just carry on as we are. But what they're going to do is they're going to get rid of compulsory competitive tendering, and they're going to just have what they call integrated care, but Virgin Medical are going to be on the boards, which will decide who gets the contract, and they're not going to go out to tender. Mm. So you can see where this is going.
But, I mean, what about the main point that he's making there, that if you've had COVID recovered, you've got 7 to 8 different antibodies. If you've got the mRNA vaccine, then you've only got one.
Yeah, well, the mRNA vaccine, which is the Pfizer vaccine, is different to the other vaccines.
Moderna.
Yeah, because, in other words, it really is an experimental technology.
In another part of this interview, he was saying that actually the AstraZeneca is using has a similar effect, although it's using a different mechanism to get that into your body. It's a similar effect. And he does go into quite a lot of detail in this interview, which I'll put a full version, I promise. I didn't do it last week. I'm not supposed to. And I'll put some of the last week's up, I'm sure, later tonight. There's one or two interviews, long interviews, I didn't put up last week. But I will, this one, definitely, with Dr. Stanley Laham. It's a fascinating education into how the body's immune system works. So, Ian, I don't know if you want to comment on this. I mean, what he's saying there is that you're a lot better off with the antibodies that your body naturally would create to if you've caught COVID than if you're having a vaccine. And it's much better to just not have a vaccine if you've had COVID.
Well,
we're not being told that, are we? We're not being told that at all.
There's loads of things we're not being told, particularly the ivermectin and the hydrochloroquine stories and the paper which was withdrawn from The Lancet. I imagine you've covered that on this show.
Yeah,
already.
We have. Yeah. That was about chloroquine, wasn't it? The paper that was made up by some comedian, and The Lancet, like the bunch of comedians that they are, published it without checking anything.
And it killed the research projects, not before several key research projects had been called off.
Well, I mean, if I was a Pfizer or Moderna shareholder, I wouldn't really mind too much about that.
No, I'd be very happy as well. One other thing, just to mention, it's slightly off at a tangent here. A lot of these problems in China, you know, people are saying we shouldn't eat so much meat. We shouldn't have it in vicious factory farms where the animals are all stressed, catching diseases from each other. You know, that's something we might just bear in mind.
But the main point he's making, I think, there, Martin, is that if you have both, right? So in other words, if you've already had COVID and you've got a vaccine on top of that, then you're liable to potentially get an autoimmune disease when you get COVID or a similar virus in the future. So what it's doing is it's basically confusing your body's immune system. It's saying, well, the body's immune system is trying to do one thing, and then the vaccine and this mRNA vaccine is trying to do something different at the same time. You could actually end up with your body fighting its own cells.
Well, it may well be in the fullness of time that it becomes clear that all the vaccines or some of them are dangerous because they haven't done the proper testing, have they? And of course, the big pharma are definitely pushing this. As the previous guy said, it's either deliberate or it's accidental, and it's disaster capitalism. They've just battened onto something which is a natural event and turned it into something.
Yeah, actually, Stanley is big on that. He always mentions the Naomi Klein disaster capitalism.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think we're 9/11 truth people. We know that they can and do things like this. They're quite capable of this. They are very evil. Otherwise, they're every bit as evil as Adolf Hitler. That's how evil they are.
The big advantage, of course, with the piggyback approach is that you didn't do it in the first place, so nobody can catch you having done it.
Exactly,
what you've done is to piggyback on it.
That's right. But I think in order to keep a sceptical head on, we've got to presume that it may well, as you say, to be something to do with animal rearing and all the rest of it. Don't forget, in the US, the animals are routinely fed antibiotics all the time.
Terrible.
And then, of course, the meat is actually stuffed with antibiotics. And eventually what you're doing is you're destroying the population's capacity to absorb antibiotics.
So let's just move on to the next clip from Stanley Laham. And here he talks about something which, Martin, you, when I was over in New Zealand, raised. And I was thinking, what is he on about here? I love it when you do that, because you were absolutely on the ball with this whole thing of the cytokine storm. This is an autoimmune response from your body, and it was actually what was killing most of the COVID patients in the hospitals and the ventilators, who, for whatever reason, the hospital protocols were saying we mustn't treat these people, even though there are treatments available. They were being allowed to die, effectively put onto ventilators and being treated for pneumonia when they didn't have pneumonia at all. They had SARS, because it's called SARS-CoV-2. The clue is in the name. And that what was killing them was this cytokine storm, which was going on inside people's lungs. I mean, it looked on the surface, I suppose, if, in a superficial fashion, as if it might be pneumonia, but it wasn't. And so I asked Dr. Stanley Laham all about what is this cytokine storm, and can you eat a particular diet to make sure that you don't, or are there things you can take, dietary supplements, but to limit the possibility that your immune system is going to go haywire in this way?
The cytokine storm causes mini thrombosis in a lot, you know, in the capillaries where the alveoli of the lungs are. The alveoli of the lungs, their function is to take the oxygen you breathe in and give it to the hemoglobin of the blood circulating through them. Now, if you have some mini blood clots blocking that, you're obviously not going to get the oxygen. The oxygen will not be transferred to the hemoglobin. Now, the cytokine storm in general, this is again, like I told you, caused by mast cells that release too much. They have their functions. They have their beneficial function. But when they're too much is released, you get this inflammatory response. You get all these blood clots caused in the capillaries because of the inflammation in them. And they are caused by what they call the cells that release these cytokines are called mast cells. And usually they are activated by immunoglobulin E, IgE, that you form to the virus. Now, is there a kind of diet that can... I don't know. I don't know if there's if a special diet can help you reduce the chance of producing IgE as opposed to IgG. It's possible, but coming to that, yes. Whether it's vitamin D, whether it's zinc, whether it's hydroxychloroquine, they all have what they call a modulating effect on the immune system. So they will help. This is why at the beginning, when hydroxychloroquine was recommended and that nobody seemed to have paid any attention, the journal Nature Cellular Biology, you know, had articles showing that not only that it does inhibit the SARS-CoV-2 replication in culture, that is in vitro, when you have tissue cultures, nasopharyngeal tissue cultures of nasopharyngeal cells, and you infect them with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It was shown that the chloroquine inhibits its growth. Plus, chloroquine had that other benefit, which is why it's been used for the last two decades as an immune modulator in the autoimmune diseases called rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus. It's part of the regimen to control, but there are no viruses involved in those diseases. These are autoimmune diseases where your immune system is attacking itself, different parts, depending on which autoimmune disease you have. And chloroquine was found to moderate the immune system to make it less deadly against itself, to make it have less of a reaction against self-antigens. That's why we call it an immune modulator.
Okay, so I mean, I just find this stuff fascinating. So there are various substances that you can take which will reduce the cytokine storm. It's just that in the protocols which were put out here by the National Health Service and by the CDC in the United States, there was no mention of this to limit the effects of the cytokine storm. Things like vitamin D, zinc, and chloroquine do quite a good job as immune system moderators that mean that potentially you won't die. And yet none of this was rolled out at the time. I'm not sure if I've got to quite got my head around the details of immunoglobulin E and immunoglobulin G. Which of those two are the best? Apparently the G stuff is what you want and the E stuff is what you don't want. That can kill you in a cytokine storm. So, but it's, you know, it's interesting, I think, to get into the details of some of, you know, what has actually been going on during, you know, the tens of thousands of deaths we've had just in this country of people with COVID-19. Anyway, there's we've got another couple of clips from Stanley, but the next one really, and I wanted to ask him about ivermectin, because, you know, it's Global Ivermectin Day is coming up soon. How does ivermectin actually work?
It stops the virus both extracellularly from attaching and intracellularly. Once inside, the mRNA of the virus, which is an RNA, it's a long piece of mRNA. It has to go to the ribosomes where it's translated into new virus. It inhibits it at the ribosomal stage.
So that's, I mean, it's pretty clear. As the virus comes into your body and it targets a cell, the idea is the virus attaches itself to the outside of your cell, injects itself into your cell, so the ivermectin gets in the way, stops it getting in. And also, once it's in your cell, and this is incredible stuff, I find, because it needs to go into the ribosome, which is a part of your cell inside the cell, it also stops the virus from getting into there too. So it's just in the way, and it's a fantastic little thing. It's called ivermectin. And so we've got Global Ivermectin Day, which has been set up by BIRD, which is this ivermectin doctors campaigning group here in the UK, for Saturday the 24th of July 2021. That's this year, so it's very, very soon. Saturday to 24th of July, next Saturday.
Obviously, it all has to do with money, the money that the big pharma thinks it can make from this disaster. There was a book written called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, how every, from a pandemic to an earthquake, can be used to make a lot of money for those, for the oligarchs who are already there. And I think that's the story of COVID-19. We had a president, Mr. Trump, whom I considered has the intellect of a seventh grader, but who spoke a truth, and because of political reason, they shut him up. If they can prevent a president of the United States of America from talking, you can imagine they can stop a doctor. Now, the problem is nobody had the gut. If all the doctors put together and say, yes, ivermectin, then people would have to listen, even big pharma. But unfortunately, at least in the United States, and I'm sure the same in England, the American Medical Association is almost a wholly owned subsidiary of big pharma. So that answers your question, why nobody publishes. Big corporations look after big corporations.
Martin?
Well, I think that's you know, that's obviously the case. I think we're really discussing here whether the disaster capitalism aspects of this are pretty clear. I mean, I've been vaccinated because basically from a day-to-day basis, I'm going to work and so on. That's what I'm expected to do. And, you know, I can't retire. I'm 61. I've got seven more years to work in schools, you know. So that's what, and you put in a position where you've got to do that, really, or not. But if we don't, I mean, we then get questions about when can we end the lockdown? I mean, you saw Johnson earlier pushing vaccination is the way to end the lockdown. So you can see
even if you've already had COVID-19, as we've just heard, yeah. Utter nonsense.
Yeah, but one of the other things I would make this point about Haiti and lots of other countries is people don't get, in India, people don't get medical care at all. They don't get vaccines. They don't get ivermectin. They never see a doctor. And that's true of large numbers of people in the United States.
That's just simply not true in India, that ivermectin was being used all the time.
Yes, but not everybody got it, because most people don't see doctors at all.
Well, what they did in India is they made it very available. I mean, they actually had factories. I'm not sure where I heard this. I think it might have been Lee Merritt's interview earlier, that India is one of the places in the world which has the most manufacturing of ivermectin going on. And two of the precursor plants for ivermectin burnt down in 2020. So this was obviously this was something which was being churned out, was basically being used. I mean, they're very cheap pills in order to give to people who in the first stages of symptoms to stop them being hospitalised. It's just not the case in India that there wasn't access to ivermectin. There was access to ivermectin, not maybe as much as we might have had here, but we had nothing here.
Well, no they had more access in India. But of course, lots of people in India never ever see a doctor and take no conventional medicine of any kind. And that is true also in Haiti.
But they were actually quite well organised in India with ivermectin before the whole vaccine thing kicked in. And once they started introducing vaccines at the beginning of this year, they then prevented the use of ivermectin. And then by March this year, we had a big problem in India. Lots of people dying in India. And the so-called Indian variant, which actually wasn't an Indian variant at all, by the way, as Stanley keeps pointing out, this is just the first place where it's been discovered. That's not the origin necessarily. Anyway, I thought we'd just revisit Alex Craner's chat from a couple of weeks ago. He's this former hedge fund manager based in Monaco, originally from the Balkans. And he was saying some fascinating stuff about the Theranos scandal. This woman, Elizabeth Holmes, that managed to get all the top people on her board, including Henry Kissinger, running this company, which was a medical test fraud. It turned up billions of pounds. She became worth billions of pounds. What she said she was doing was creating a medical test kit where you could take one drop of someone's blood and test them for hundreds of different things. And this was a great idea, of course, if it worked. The only thing was, it was a complete fraud and it didn't work. What Alex was saying was that this whole idea of medical test fraud could have been a sort of precursor to what we're seeing today with the false positives from the PCR tests, etc., etc., an attempt to create a very simple system where you can be tested and then instantly, basically by a computer, not by a doctor, be told, this is the treatment, have this vaccine. So let's have a listen now to a little bit about this story of the Theranos scandal on the west coast of the US. And Elizabeth Holmes, who's at the centre of this, is still right now on trial.
Cracks were beginning to crumble the empire. Richard, by this stage, had created a gang of Theranos sceptics, including Ian's widow, Rochelle. They collected information and then took it to John Kerryrew at the Wall Street Journal. As John began investigating, countless sources and former employees came out of the woodwork. They anonymously provided information about the story. Theranos attacked everyone who was talking. They used their pile of money and they threatened to sue everyone else who spoke to the Wall Street Journal. They even hired private investigators to stalk anyone they suspected. Several letters were sent to the Wall Street Journal to try and kill the story, threatening defamation lawsuits. Rupert Murdoch, the owner of the Wall Street Journal and investor in Theranos, was asked by Elizabeth to personally kill the story. He refused, stating that he had confidence in the editors to handle the truth, whatever it may be. The reaction from Theranos was intense, and the story wasn't even out yet. Business as usual continued at Theranos. Elizabeth was making White House appearances often then, but under the veneer, the machines could still only do a small number of tests and were inaccurate with even just those. Theranos continued to demonstrate the mini-lab for VIP guests. They pricked their finger, then waited until they left, and then went on to use existing commercial third-party lab machines to return the results. Vice President Joe Biden even paid Theranos a visit. He was shown a fake lab that was set up just for the visit. He was impressed, saying that it was the lab of the future, and praised Theranos. The dark truth about Theranos was finally unveiled in the Wall Street Journal article of October 15th, 2015. It was a bombshell. All the major news articles picked it up. People began questioning Theranos and its secrecy. Elizabeth took it all in her stride, not shying away from the questions, but instead, outright lying to the public. It appeared that she thought everyone would just believe her again, but this time it was different. Now people were asking serious questions.
And just this morning, the Wall Street Journal ran a pretty scathing article about the company, alleging that the company's proprietary testing devices may be inaccurate, and basically accusing Theranos of deceptive practices. To Elizabeth Holmes, the founder and CEO of Theranos, give her a chance to answer the charges raised in the article. Ms. Holmes, welcome back to Mad Money.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What do you think's going on here?
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world. And I have to say, I personally was shocked to see that the journal would publish something like this.
Just as the story had been published, the FDA made a surprise inspection at Theranos. In further investigations, it was found that the Theranos Edison blood testing machine only performed 12 out of 250 tests, and even those produced wildly erratic results. Now, Theranos was in full damage control. Elizabeth broke up with Sonny and fired him. A criminal investigation was underway, and a probe by the Securities and Exchange Commission was also proceeding. The investors began suing Theranos one by one. Partner Fund sued for $100 million, Walgreens for $140 million. Elizabeth had to close the trial lab and had to pay $4.5 million to Arizona State, where most patients had received testing. Theranos had voided nearly a million lab results. 10 patients would sue Theranos for medical battery. But shockingly, amongst all of this, Elizabeth never apologized. It seemed to her merely a mistake along the way which could be fixed.
So, that's a shortish half an extract from a half-hour documentary into the Theranos scandal. Martin, look, you've got here a massive, I mean, we're talking about something like $6 billion was put into this firm. It was worth at $1.6 billion anyway, because there were great high hopes for it. One of the most fascinating things that you were saying there was that Rupert Murdoch was an investor. So she, Elizabeth Holmes, obviously thought that because he was an investor in the firm that he wouldn't trash it in the Wall Street Journal. But he said, actually, I'm going to let my journalists get on and do their job.
Yeah, I read an article about this in the London Review of Books about a year ago. And of course, it just shows how completely corrupt the system in the US is for medical care for people. So this is basically a techie whiz kid woman. You know, she's basically from Silicon Valley. And they're pushing the idea, and of course you've got Peter Thiel trying to take over the NHS's database, that big data will allow you to predict people's illnesses in advance. So the idea was that people would just give one blood sample, and then all of these, that they were able to predict their future medical history.
Well, just also, the,
which
I mean,
if you think about it,
they would be able to
send
a little note to your GP, telling your GP what treatment you needed.
Yes. So the Silicon Valley are trying to get into medical care on the back of, you know, we're going to use big data to predict stuff. But of course, this whole question of whether NHS data should be allowed to be passed to third parties is an issue. Because of course, if it gets into the hands of insurance companies and the NHS collapses in my lifetime, which I think is quite possible, then you're just not going to get insurance if you're not very well. I mean, people who've got basically endemic conditions can't get insurance in the United States of America. And even ordinary people, if they get sick, can expect to go bankrupt.
Well, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States seems to be a little bit more robust than our city watchdogs here in Britain, because they are prosecuting, although it's taken many years to actually do this. Well, it's 5 years or so now to actually get a prosecution. The trial is set to begin next month, so she's managed to put it off incredibly. Whoever is trying to prosecute her, this has all been put off for years. But this August, apparently, the delays were due to the coronavirus. I don't know. Apparently, no trials can take place because of the coronavirus. Maybe. And also, her unexpected pregnancy has also caused more delays to the trial. This is the journalist Cario, who at the Wall Street Journal predicts that she will be convicted of wire fraud, and that said a guilty verdict in a trial will be a major shot across the bows to so-called entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. The message will be, you can't do anything you want. You can't completely ignore rules and regulations. You have to actually evidence companies' potential. So that surely is a good thing.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, what the courts in the US are concerned about is that the investors have lost their money. not that what we're actually dealing with here is criminal medical fraud.
Well, that's probably what's driving it, yeah. But the thing is, what he's also saying is that a not guilty verdict will set a dangerous precedent for startup CEOs. Young entrepreneurs will say, look what Elizabeth Holmes got away with, and she didn't go to prison for it. So it's quite an important case that's coming up, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, even if she got convicted... it's not going to deter, that will just set a boundary within which tech entrepreneurs will try and function. And, a lot of the tech firms are not in fact viable. They are based on hype. I mean, Uber, for example, hasn't actually made any profits.
Well, surely. Hang on. Uber is surely viable.
No, it's not. It's not. This is the truth. I mean, the way the tech industry works is you create a concept, good or bad, you sell it to investors, and then you walk away with the money. And then, of course, it's basically what they're investing in is the share price going up. And, of course, the continuous money printing to deal with COVID, to deal with the financial crash, to deal with 9/11 means that it's money for old rope if you're investing in these stocks,
so anyway,
especially if you sell them at the right moment.
Well, okay. So with the actual COVID crisis itself, we've seen tens of thousands of people die, hundreds of thousands, millions of people around the world dying with COVID-19 unnecessarily because of the blocking of treatment. And I wonder, before we hear from our next clip, Martin, what you think of the idea that that this could be a deliberate sort of culling of the population. That's something that you won't hear on the BBC, but we talk about it here week after week. Do you think it's feasible?
Well, I think some of the ideology behind people like Bill Gates is clearly Malthusian. You know, there's too many people, too many poor people. And we saw it when some Tory councillor here, when Marcus Rashford was pushing for, school meals in the holidays.
It's a bit closer to home, though. It's not just Bill Gates, is it? We've had Prince Charles saying that he thinks that actually what we will need is three or four planets to all the people. So, in other words, that something like three quarters of the world's population is going to have to go.
Well, yeah, this Tory local councillor said when all this controversy was going on about Rashford, he's saying, well, if you can't feed, don't breed. Yeah, and that is an attitude amongst but billionaires. But underlying all of this is the control of resources, the removal of potential rivals in China and Russia, etc.
Means the masses, doesn't it? Potential rivals is the masses.
That's
nowadays.
That's what the Chinese would say, yeah. Because we've got a quarter of the world's population inside our borders.
But I'm talking about domestically here. The rivals to the Gates are the masses in America. These people, in order to get away with what they want to do, have got to face down the general population. That seems to me is to, since the end of the American adventure in the Middle East, with the Russians blocking their takeover of Syria, etc., that the eye of Sauron has now swiveled and it's turned on its own domestic population.
Well, that's how empires collapse, you know, historically. I mean, defeat at the periphery, like the loss of the Tsarist fleet being sunk by the Japanese at Tsushima in 1905, then led to the 1905 revolution, the defeat of the Americans in Vietnam and now in Afghanistan. Ultimately, the system that they're running depends upon the dollar being the world's reserve currency, and that means dominating the whole park. It's no longer feasible with China, the workshop of the world, state-run banks which can't be bankrupted by them. It's a real challenge for them. And, of course, what they could do is just adapt and try and negotiate. But that is not the mentality, is it? They'd rather unleash something like COVID.
So I think it was Alex Craner a few years ago. He said that he thinks the West is going to collapse rather like the Soviet Union did.
Well, that's quite likely. I mean, but of course it won't necessarily be a positive thing, just like the collapse of the Soviet Union wasn't necessarily a positive thing. All this historical antagonism between different groups, the complete collapse of living standards. I mean, most people do not understand what happened in Russia in the 90s.
Modern Russia is far better than it was under the Soviet system. Now Putin has sort of brought things together there.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. I mean, basically in the 90s, the Communist Party were about to win the presidential election. And that's when the bombs went off in Moscow and Ryazan. And of course, it was perfectly normal. I was working in Eastern Europe at the time, and every single communist country, apart from Bulgaria, who elected the communists in their first free election, now called the Bulgarian Socialist Party, the second election in Poland even, the Social Democrats won it, which is the former Communist Party. And that's what happened all over Eastern Europe, because as soon as people tasted raw capitalism. They thought, bloody hell, we don't want any more of this.
We've had enough of that. Okay, anyway, so there's been a fantastic series. I'm not sure if it's finished now, just a two-part series by an excellent journalist. He's a disabled guy. He's got something called neurofibromatosis, otherwise known as NF, Adam Pearson, and he's been doing this series for the BBC about eugenics. And the title of the series is Eugenics, Science's Greatest Scandal. It's been on BBC Four. But unbelievably, it's been on at 1 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is an absolutely devastating, brilliant piece of work by one of the best journalists, a disabled guy in the country. And why are they putting it on at 1 a.m.?
So that nobody will watch it. I mean, why do you have to ask?
So let's have a listen now to a little clip from that. This is Adam Pearson looking at the modern eugenics movement.
In November 2018, Chinese scientist He Jiankui, or JK as he refers to himself, stunned the world when he made an announcement at a genetics conference in Hong Kong.
First of all, that we didn't know when he accepted the invitation to come and speak to us, any of the work that he's now going to talk about.
Leading British geneticist Robin Lovell Badge was one of the conference organisers.
His hero is Bob Edwards, the pioneer of in vitro fertilisation. He told me that, you know, he wanted to emulate this. He wanted to do something that would be of benefit to millions of people.
For the last 3 years, JK had been performing gene editing experiments in secret on humans.
He was driven by huge ambition, and he was very wealthy.
JK recruited 7 couples where the man was HIV positive. He told them he could use gene editing to make their children immune to the disease. Gene editing works thanks to something called CRISPR-Cas9, a programmable molecular scissor. This can be programmed to find a specific location on the DNA molecule and cut it. Then a new piece of genetic code can be inserted there. JK tried to use this technique to give embryos something called a CCR5 Delta 32 mutation. People born with this can be resistant to HIV. In late 2018, twin girls were born who had undergone JK's gene editing. But it seems although he had made some change to the baby's genes, it wasn't the ones he'd intended.
He didn't actually make the Delta 32 mutation, which we understand something about. He made completely random mutations, but we don't know the consequences of the specific mutations he's made in the gene.
Hi, I'm Anna Middleton and I'm head of society.
The conference attendees were shocked.
We were just stunned because basically what he had done was completely outside all ethical frameworks that we all stand by. It's illegal in many countries and he was completely unregulated. And we've learned since that the ethics process that he claimed to have gone through wasn't real, it was fake, and the consent process that the families apparently engaged with was also not real and true. So it was fraudulent.
After the huge international outcry against his work, JK is reported to be under house arrest in China. So, where does all this leave us with the hype over designer babies? At present, scientists have had some limited success editing genes in mice. How successful?
Well, that's the problem. At the moment, it's not efficient enough. So when we're doing experiments in mice, occasionally it works really well. We get maybe 90%, 95%, sometimes 100% of the mice born carrying the particular genetic alteration we wanted. But often it's not that efficient. It's down to about 20% or so. So that's not good enough. If we really want to use these techniques, we have to know that they're going to work.
Well, that's pretty shocking stuff. He's very he understates this, Adam Pearson. I mean, he's the victim of neurofibromatosis himself, and obviously one of the things that they're talking about doing here, Martin, is to make sure they can identify anybody like him in the womb and terminate the pregnancy immediately. So this is another aspect of this amazing programme that the BBC is shamefully putting on at 1 o'clock in the morning. The other thing he's saying there is that he's doing making these promises to these seven couples that their kids can be immune to AIDS, but then what he's doing is he's sending in some sort of gene editing mechanism into the DNA of the embryo, which is just chopping around making random mutations.
Well, it's medical fraud, isn't it? No other word for it. And of course, the victims of this are extremely wealthy people themselves who are trying to get designer babies.
But this is really a eugenics agenda that's being pushed here. Eugenics being, it's always useful to define these terms, a set of beliefs and practices that aim to improve the genetic quality of the human population. Historically, this is excluding people and groups judged to be inferior and promoting those judged to be superior. So, yeah. Obviously, disabled people are assumed by eugenicists to be useless.
Well, you could argue that that there is a legitimate reason to try and develop techniques to improve, the genetic survival of diseases and so on and so forth. But of course, and eugenics has been very popular across the spectrum politically until the Second World War. Well, H.G. Wells believed that, the poorer people of the poorer races would have to be, they would have to disappear.
Bertrand Russell and others, yeah. So, I mean, it was the other thing Adam talks about, and it's a brilliant program. I just think it's so disgusting that they, stick it on the graveyard slot. Absolutely appalling. And it just shows you, the mentality of the people running the BBC these days Adam is pointing out quite a lot about, what's been going on. He's basically saying there that there is this kind of designer baby program going on, Martin, and it's almost an unstoppable force because there's big money behind it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we mentioned the Israeli academic Harari, didn't we, who wrote these books.
Was that last week?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I read his books in lockdown because they were in W.H. Smith's, the bookshops were shut. But I mean, he's pointing out that one of the things driving this is the desire of very wealthy people to have designer babies. But that's only one side of what you might call eugenics. The other side of eugenics is killing off poor people because they're useless eaters. We don't need them.
There is another side which I wouldn't call eugenics, but logically has to be mentioned, I think, at this point, Martin, which is there are people who think that there are just too many humans on the planet and that they can quite easily be got rid of, not by any form of mass murder, not by any form of science, but simply paying women a basic income and giving them the right to choose whether they want to have babies or not. Solve the population problem. Are the so-called anti-eugenicists, are they saying that women should not be allowed to control? Because I think a lot of them probably are.
Because
look at American donations to aid agencies, if you're recommending abortions, you won't get any money from America.
Well, indeed, the other thing they do is that they've been creating infertility in populations. So we know that Bill Gates' polio, they built in infertility into what they were doing. Of course, that's a very soft form of reducing the population. Yeah. So you don't actually kill people, but they can't have babies.
But there's an even softer form, which is the one I described, security.
Well, indeed, in Kerala, in southern India, which has been run by the Communist Party since the 1940s, they have an average of one child per family.
Yeah.
And it's not through any coercion.
No.
It's because they basically gave people social security, a bit of land
to
live on.
That one of the main drivers on this planet of this whole idea, we've got to reduce the world's population, lives just down the road from here at Highgrove House. His name is Prince Charles, and he murdered his wife. Well, he didn't actually do it, but that's the sort of thing I find. We kind of skirt around these things sometimes. So I thought I'd better just say that. Anyway, so that's Adam Pearson. The other thing, Martin, he doesn't shirk in that series at all. He points the finger most directly at the UK, at Britain, as being initially behind this. Something that the Nazis picked up in between the wars, but the British really. This was a British thing, I suppose. When it was the days of empire, we thought we ruled the world.
Yeah, well, Churchill was openly of the view that poor people should be, got rid of. And it's all very well people saying yes, but he saved us in the war and all the rest of it. But people should, you know, people should be honest. That was the view. It still is the view in private amongst wealthy people. There's too many people. Now, of course, there is an issue about population. There's no doubt about it. But of course, in some countries like Kerala in India, they've dealt with it.
In China now
they've got a problem, which is they haven't got enough young people coming into the workforce.
So is the problem with the population or the distribution of wealth and food?
The problem is fundamentally the distribution of wealth and food.
There is, however, a problem which, you know, Putin was mentioning, I think, obliquely, which is that although, you know, there is a view that says the problem isn't too many people, the problem's too many Americans because they consume, yes, which is right, sort of true. Fair but enough. The problem is that all these other people, they all aspire to be Americans, you know, and to have too many of them, you know, and who wouldn't if you're living in a horrible little village in India?
Well, I'm afraid it's becoming less and less attractive to be an American and live in America as things, as the empire slides down. You know, the chute down into the dustbin. But anyway, look, we're nearly winding up now, and as our penultimate piece this evening, I thought we'd hear about this Fourth Reich, which is who owns everything. These two, a brilliant video I came across, someone sent me, I'm sure, from, it looks like the source of it is a website called greatawakening.world. I didn't even know .world could be a subdomain or whatever they call these things. But anyway, it's, I think, an excellent examination of, and of course, this reminds me, Martin, of when I did my research into, and in fact, I did several reviews of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, who was this top CBS guy during World War II. And he was saying, look, you, in order to understand what's going on in warfare in the Second World War, you've got to look very closely at the ownership of banks, the ownership of businesses, and particularly the stock, who owns the stock. And that's who, what this Dutch woman, who seems to be anonymous, goes into in this Who Runs the World documentary, which was originally done in Dutch, but has also now got an English translation version. So let's have a listen to this now. It's really looking at these two massive, massive investment companies, BlackRock and Vanguard, who seem to own the world.
Less than a handful of big corporations dominate every aspect of our lives. That may seem exaggerated, but from the breakfast we eat to the mattress we sleep on and everything we wear and consume in between is largely dependent on these corporations. Those are huge investment companies that determine the course of money flow. They are the main characters of the play that we are witnessing. How does it work? Let's take PepsiCo as an example. It is the parent company of many soda companies and snack companies. The so-called competitive brands are from factories from a few corporations who monopolize the entire industry. In the packaged food industry, there are a few big companies like Unilever, the Coca-Cola company, Mondelez and Nestle. In the picture, you see that most brands in the food industry belong to one of these corporations. The big companies are on the stock market and have the big shareholders in the board of directors. On sources like Yahoo Finance, we can see detailed company info, such as who the biggest shareholders actually are. Let's take PepsiCo again as an example. As you can see, only 10 of the investors own together nearly one-third of the stock. The top 10 of investors together amount to a value of $59 billion. But out of those 10, only 3 own more stock than the other 7. Let's remember them and look up who owns the most stocks of the Coca-Cola company, the biggest competitor of Pepsi. The biggest lump of stock is again owned by institutional investors. Let's look at the top 10 and start at the bottom 6 of them. 4 of these institutional investors we also saw at the bottom 6 of PepsiCo. These are Northern Trust, JP Morgan Chase, Geode Capital Management and Wellington Management. Now let's look at the 4 biggest stock owners. They are BlackRock, Vanguard and State Street. These are the world's biggest investment firms. So PepsiCo and Coca-Cola are not competitors at all. The other big companies that own a myriad of brand names like Unilever, Mondelez and Nestlé are from the same small group of investors. But it's not only in the food industry that their names come up. Let's find out on Wikipedia which are the biggest tech companies. Facebook is the owner of WhatsApp and Instagram. Together with Twitter, they form the most popular social media platforms. Alphabet is the parent of all Google companies like YouTube and Gmail. but they are also the biggest investor in Android, one of the two operating systems for nearly all smartphones and tablets. The other operating system is Apple's iOS. If we add Microsoft to the above three, we see four companies making the software for nearly all computers, tablets and smartphones in the world. Let's see who are the biggest shareholders of these companies. Take Facebook. We see that 80% of the stock is owned by institutional investors. These are the same names that came up in the food industry. The same investors are in the top three. Next is Twitter. It forms with Facebook and Instagram the top three. Surprisingly, this company is in the hands of the same investors as well. We see them again with Apple and even with their biggest competitor, Microsoft. Also, if we look at other big companies in the tech industry that develop and make our computers, TVs, phones and home appliances, we see the same big investors that together own the majority of the stock. It's true for all industries, I'm not exaggerating. One last example, let's book a holiday. On a computer or a smartphone, we search for a flight to a sunny country on Skyscanner or Expedia. Both are from the same small group of investors. We fly with one of the many airlines, many of which are in the hands of the same investors and of governments, as is the case with Air France KLM. The plane we board is in most cases a Boeing or an Airbus, also owned by the same names. We book through Booking.com or Airbnb, and when we arrive we go out for dinner and place a comment on TripAdvisor. The same big investors show up in every aspect of our trip. And their power is even bigger because of the kerosene is from their oil companies or refineries. The steel from which the plane is made comes from their mining companies. This small group of investment firms and funds and banks are namely also the biggest investors in the industry that dig for raw materials. Wikipedia shows that the biggest mining companies have the same big investors that we see everywhere. Also the big agricultural businesses on which the entire food industry depends. They own Bayer, the parent company of Monsanto, the biggest seed producer in the world.
So, I mean, that's altogether, I think, about a 30-minute video. There's a little extract from it there. That Dutch brain box, she wants to remain anonymous, I think. I couldn't find her name out. But what she's saying, Martin, is pretty devastating, isn't it, really, that BlackRock and Vanguard, all the things that we think are in competition with each other, whether it's Boeing and Airbus or Apple and Microsoft or Coke and Pepsi, these guys have got majority shareholdings. Well, actually, not necessarily majority shareholdings, but between them, they may have a majority shareholding in everything.
Yeah, well, I'd make two points. One is that in a classic economics textbook, the point about branding is it creates a barrier to entry to new entrants into an industry.
Well, what do you mean about branding?
Well, you've got Pepsi and Coca-Cola, for example.
Yeah.
Now, they spend an awful lot of money selling Pepsi and Coca-Cola. And you think, well, this is a waste of money. It doesn't matter what people buy. If you own both of them, then it doesn't matter which one they buy. But by spending loads and loads of money, you prevent a third party from entering the market. This is what's technically called barriers to entry. Yeah? So you create barriers to entry.
So if yes, please.
When I started publishing my magazine, Outlook, years ago, I got on well with Smith's distribution people, otherwise they wouldn't have published it. It ran into problems, and I went there to discuss it with them. And the guy looked at me in the face, quite seriously, was not joking, and he said, "Why don't you start a competitor?"
Yeah, well, this is the illusion.
Exactly,
this is the illusion you're making. Capitalism. But anyway, even in basic economics textbooks, this is what's called barriers to entry. I'd make a further point about BlackRock. In September 2019, there was a meltdown in the repo market in the United States, in Wall Street. It was every bit as serious as what had happened in 2008. Now, what happened in 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, was that there was no mechanism for bailing out non-bank entities, like Goldman Sachs. So a whole system had to be cobbled together so that Goldman Sachs converted itself to a bank so that it could be officially bailed out. And then the US taxpayer was put on the hook, just as the British taxpayer was put on the hook. Now, you could argue, if you're going to follow a free market philosophy, that if the people running the banking industry go bankrupt, you just let them go bankrupt.
But this is like a kind of robbery of Fort Knox.
Well, it is, but there's nothing in Fort Knox.
Well,
as we know.
Okay, as we know. But, yeah.
If you got into Fort Knox, you wouldn't find
Well, whatever, the US Treasury, anyway.
Yeah, but anyway, what happened in 2019 was that we didn't know about it at the time because it was all kept under wraps. There had been a problem in the repo market in Wall Street, and there was already a mechanism to go to deal with that. So what they've done since 2008, we've created this emergency mechanism to bail the banks out. And that emergency mechanism was then activated. And what it led to is BlackRock basically taking over the functions both of the Federal Reserve and of the US Treasury. So the bailout money was going to be channeled through BlackRock as the experts in the market. And they then decided which companies were going to be bailed out and which companies were not. And don't forget, they're bailing out their own stuff.
Have you run into the American campaigner, Ellen Brown? She writes very good stuff on this sort of thing.
Ellen Brown.
Yeah. I think it's more or less what you were saying. But what she explained was that the banks lent the money to BlackRock, and BlackRock used the money to buy everything.
Yeah.
And that's how they're.
Yeah, and then when the banks go bust, BlackRock come in and say, well, we're the creditors, so there we are.
Well, of course.
And of course, they're also a part of the government, even though they're a private company. So they are deciding who gets bailed out. If you have the government, the Federal Reserve is a private organisation, of course, but the Treasury isn't supposed to be. If they have the government deciding who will be bailed out, you can just say, BlackRock, we're not bailing you out. But they're not doing that because it's what's called regulatory capture. They've captured the institutions which are supposed to keep them under control.
Okay, Martin, we're about to wrap up, but I thought I'd give you a final chance to talk about what you make of this Northern Ireland amnesty this week. I was pretty shocked to see. I mean, you don't look like you were. You're turning your lip up there. To say as the families of various victims are starting to get information about crimes that were committed back in the Troubles, it seems as if there's an attempt now to just cover this whole thing up. Now, the actual story is mass amnesty set to end. 1,200 prosecutions are going to be thrown out linked to the Troubles. This is in the I paper this week. More than 1,000 crimes linked to the Northern Irish Troubles will be dropped under government plans for a mass amnesty which will end the prosecutions of military veterans and former paramilitaries alike.
Well, what strikes me about this is that they haven't consulted with anybody before coming up with this. So nobody is happy with it. Sinn Féin are against it. The Democratic Unionist Party
are
against
it. Why are they doing it then?
The reason they're doing it is that the Daily Mail has been pursuing a campaign that the elderly grunts who carried out, for example, the murders in Ballymurphy or on Bloody Sunday shouldn't be prosecuted.
Didn't we have a panorama a few years ago where it showed that a British Army officer was trying to run away from the camera because he had been involved in murders too?
Yes, well, in actual fact, on Bloody Sunday, the person who should have stood trial was General Robert Ford, who gave the orders for it. Because it wasn't just soldiers opening up. They've been primed to kill people before they set off.
And Peter Carrington at the Department for Defence, the former chairman of the Bilderbergs.
Now, and of course, the Good Friday Agreement agreed was that we paramilitaries were going to be released from prison from prison terms that they were serving, whether Republican or Loyalist, and that that there wasn't going to be a blanket amnesty, because you could have had a truth and reconciliation process like in South Africa, where everybody comes forward and just says what they did. So that Brigadier Gordon Kerr, for example, this is not, everybody's talking about British veterans as these old private soldiers who are now 80 and it's just silly to prosecute them. But of course the real person who should be prosecuted is Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who ran the Force Research Unit, which orchestrated the Loyalist Terror Campaign. So all the people killed by Loyalist terrorists were actually killed indirectly by the British Army. And of course State Knife, who was the head of the IRA's Internal Discipline Unit, turned out to be working for the British all along. So a lot of Republican murders
discipline wasn't just a slap wrist, was it?
Well, no, he was the head of what they call the Nothing Squad, which was the internal security.
Well, so people were murdered.
Yes, and they were murdered on the orders of the British Army. Because they control
the IRA.
So what State Knife's job was to do was to pick on loyal volunteers who weren't traitors, accuse them of being traitors and have them tortured and murdered. Meanwhile, the people who were, in fact, British agents were being protected.
Amazing. Anyway, Julie Hambleton, whose sister died in the 1974 Birmingham pub bombings, wrote to the Prime Minister, "At what point did your government lose all sight of its moral, ethical and judicial backbone?"
Yeah, well, I've got great sympathy with the people who died in Birmingham, but of course in Dublin and Monaghan, the previous year, 27 people died, and the bombs planted, no warning bombs planted by the Glenane gang, who were related to the UDA, and the explosives came from MI5. Now, a lot of people do not, this is why Sinn Féin are opposed to this amnesty, because they want all of this stuff chased up. The DUP are opposed to this amnesty for other reasons, that they want various IRA terrorists, as they see it, to be prosecuted. And of course, what strikes me about all of this is that the British government, if it had an ounce of sense, would have talked to the DUP, for example, beforehand. And nobody in Northern Ireland, the Alliance Party, the sort of centrists, Sinn Féin, or the DUP, are happy with this amnesty. So, in other words, they're trying to push something which nobody wants.
Okay, so the announcement has been criticised by opposition parties, most politicians in Northern Ireland, victims group, and the Republic itself.
Yes, the Irish Republic isn't happy with it either. So, in other words, they've not discussed this with anybody. They're under pressure from the owners of the Daily Mail to get to a situation.
This is not about the Daily Mail.
No, it is.
The Daily Mail is a vector for this. But what is the real pressure? Surely the real pressure is coming from the Ministry of Defence saying we do not want the complicity of the British Army in causing the troubles to come out.
Well, what happened recently,
and actually former officers to be prosecuted and put behind bars.
Well, indeed, I mean, that would be a deterrent, wouldn't it?
Maybe they have the ear of the Daily Mail.
Well, but yes, indeed, and Ballymurphy was shown. I mean, it was a bigger massacre than Bloody Sunday, and it went on over several days in West Belfast. And it took place before Bloody Sunday, which everybody's heard of. And if there was a recent court case, all of the people were exonerated. The judges decided, yes, in actual fact, they were all killed out of hand by the British Army.
So it's 1,200 prosecutions, which are now going to go in the bin.
Not necessarily, because this amnesty thing isn't necessarily going to run for the reasons we've just been saying.
We shall see. Announcing the plans to the House of Commons, Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis said, "We know that the prospect of the end of criminal prosecutions will be difficult for some to accept, and that this is not a position that we take lightly. But we have come to the view that this would be the best way to facilitate an effective information retrieval and provision process, and the best way to help Northern Ireland move further along the road to reconciliation." Well, what does he mean by a effective information retrieval and provision process?
Well, they're trying to push the idea that if we get prosecutions out of the way, then everybody can come forward and say what happened. So we could have Brigadier Gordon Kerr coming forward and saying, yes, in actual fact, I did run the Loyalist Terror Campaign and we killed hundreds of people, but then that was then, this is now. So in other words, what the British government are frightened of here is that the role of the British state in running the Loyalist Terror Campaign is going to be revealed, because of course everybody's got the idea it's just the horrible IRA doing nasty stuff, and the loyalists, well, they're just as bad. But the loyalists were being directed. The chief intelligence officer of the UDA was a British Army agent, as were many people inside the IRA. So in other words,
what was the purpose of the troubles then? If it was orchestrated, Bloody Sunday clearly was a provocation. It was a murder by the parachute regiment of people who were unarmed. The idea being to really start a war, which it succeeded in doing. So what was the purpose of that?
Well, I think the thinking at the time was that if you look at the documents, they refer to the people they want to kill as the DYH, the Derry Young Hooligans. Yeah. The lads that were going out throwing rocks at them.
But did they really expect that this wasn't going to actually act as a recruiting sergeant?
Well, no, I think they really didn't.
They misread that. I don't think so. I think they wanted to create the troubles in order to create a kind of training ground in Northern Ireland.
Well,
we're coming back
to a lot of the things we've discussed in this programme, which is what is a natural disaster with disaster capitalism piling on. The British Army, in fact, basically, when the troubles broke out, thought, wow, this is a great chance for us to do some training. And, you know, I've read that they were very happy with the kind of exposure that their junior officers got, the sort of non-commissioned officers, because they were in small groups having to make decisions without anybody else to tell them what to do. So it was it's a great big training ground. Never mind marching around on Salisbury Plain.
It seemed to me to be bringing closer to home the sorts of tactics that the British Army had been using in Africa.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, they even turned up, they'd just come back from Aden, where the National Liberation Front had kicked them out, and then they turned up in Belfast.
I mean, the obvious
Belfast.
Thing to think here is, well, we thought there was a sectarian war was started between the Loyalists and the Republicans. Well, let's look at the sectarian war that's been cooked up between, for example, Sunni and Shia in other parts of the world.
Yeah,
so this is surely a divide-and-rule tactic, and they're playing with it in Northern Ireland.
But they don't forget that divide-and-rule tactic's been going on since Cromwell in Ireland. Yes, so in other words, it's not something new. So in other words, I think what happened is the civil rights movement broke out in the six counties in the late 60s because everybody was in the streets asking for all sorts, you know, and they were on the bandwagon. And of course, what that...
Oh, they were shut out of the electoral process.
Well, exactly. So they're not allowed to get anybody elected. It's all a bit of a... And initially, they were just demanding voting rights, which would then lead, for example, to get a fairer allocation of council housing, so stuff like this. But when that was met with force, and of course the loyalists getting very paranoid because they don't want to give any inch. Yeah, it was illegal, for example, in Northern Ireland to fly the Irish Tricolour. Yeah, if you fly the Irish Tricolour, you can be arrested straight away.
And you know what I see? I see this starting to be potentially rolled out in mainland UK with Priti Patel and her attempt to criminalise 10,000 travellers.
Well, it's not just the travellers. What will happen is as the economy goes down, as they withdraw furlough, because I don't think they've got any sense about that at all. They should keep it. They should keep the furlough stuff going, but they won't. And the economy will go down the drain. At that point, the inner cities will be full of very angry young men with military age. And something will kick it off. And then they can really go to town on their authoritarian state. Well, so they may bite off more than they can chew.
Well, I'm glad I gave you the opportunity to talk about Northern Ireland, but go for it, yeah.
Just once again to go off on a little bit of a tangent. I have a second identity as a coffee shop owner, as you probably know. And I do a little bit of exporting to Europe and previously to Northern Ireland. I can tell you, Brexit... is, you know, whatever you think about Brexit, I actually voted for Brexit, never imagining it would turn out in the way it did, with us sort of almost totally detached from Europe. Northern Ireland is practically facing an economic siege, you know, and you've got this whole border issue, which I'm sure you guys have discussed many times, but it really is a big, big disaster.
So you're having trouble exporting to Northern Ireland, are you?
I wouldn't even think about it. I'm having real trouble exporting to Europe. The only way I can export to mainland Europe is by getting a roaster in mainland Europe to roast my coffee for me. There's the most immense piles of bureaucracy. My coffee has now been declared perishable.
Did you used to actually export quite a bit to the continent?
Oh, yeah. It was dead easy. You just gave it to DPD. They came 20 kilos, off it went. Now, 20 kilos is seen as being perishable, so you have to have a certificate of inspection. Although Boris said no tariffs, no somethings, that, you know, what about the customs charges? What about the VAT?
So how has it affected your business then?
Well, fortunately, I didn't have much involvement with Europe, so not very much.
Okay.
It was an absolute disaster for people who were living off exporting to Europe.
Well, a fascinating little insight in there, and I hope that you've got the coffee that you said you'd bring up for us. I very much appreciate
it's there
that.
In the car, Martin.
That's the bribe. That's the bribe that I was paid to allow you to come and promote his book this evening. There you go.
Not to mention my coffee shop.
Cynical we are. Anyway, Conspiracy Classics is moving on now. It's our final item tonight from June 2021's Altian Charles expose of Freemasonry and Satanism, which we've been looking at over the last few weeks. We head back to 1980 for Conspiracy Classics number 11. It's Anthony Sutton, professor, author of Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, amongst other titles. A clip tonight about big American corporations producing armaments for Nazi Germany right through World War II, and how they also avoided getting factories which are actually over in Germany, owned by the United States, bombed.
The Ford plant in Cologne should have been a prime military target. For example, the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, did bomb the Ford plant at Poissy in France. But the Ford plant in Cologne, which was by far the largest Ford plant in Germany, was not bombed in World War II.
But did our military planners intend to bomb it? In other words, was it on the aiming report?
Well, I did look at the aiming reports for the plants in Cologne. Ford was known about. They knew that it was producing equipment for the Wehrmacht. But it was not bombed. It was scheduled as a target, but it was not bombed.
So somewhere along the line, as far as the planning was concerned, the name of the Ford motor plant in Cologne was deleted, and yet the city of Cologne itself was totally decimated.
The city of Cologne was decimated, as of course many other cities in Germany were decimated. But somewhere along the line, something happened. I suspect it was in the aiming committees, and without question, orders were sent out not to bomb certain targets, even though these were prime military targets.
And That's rather reminiscent of some of the orders that went out during the Korean War, some of the orders that went out during the Vietnamese War, to leave specific targets within the enemy's domain untouched by our strategic bombing.
I understand that was so, although I've not investigated it.
Now, in your book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, there was one very interesting section about a special fund that Heinrich Himmler had, and the funneling of money from German corporations into this fund, even up into the years 1943 and 1944. And many of these corporations had strong ties into the American corporations, into the American parent corporations. Could you tell us a little bit about the Kepler Fund?
The Kepler Fund was also known as the Konto S Fund. It was what we might call Heinrich Himmler's personal slush fund. He used it for his own personal projects. And what amazed me was both in 1933 and in 1944, the two years for which I examined the records, over half the funds came from American corporations. For example, in 1933, ITT, Standard Oil, General Electric, and possibly Osram were contributors. Even in 1944, in the middle of World War II, we find that ITT was funneling funds to Heinrich Himmler's fund through Schroeder, who was the chairman of the ITT subsidiaries in Germany. We also find that Depag, the Standard Oil subsidiary in Germany, was financing Heinrich Himmler. And this was in the middle of World War II.
Now, were these facts ever brought out at the Nuremberg hearings?
They were never brought out at the Nuremberg hearings, although the documents do exist within the files, within the records. They have not been published, as far as I know.
And you actually had access to these records?
Yes, there's some 400 tons of these records available. And many of them were at the Hoover Institution, or copies were at the Hoover Institution, and that's where I found the original documentation.
Professor Anthony Sutton there, Conspiracy Classic number 11, which is his talk about what that is actually called The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, where he talks about how the United States has been funding military production in Soviet Russia, in communist China, and most importantly there, in Nazi Germany, direct funding for Himmler, you know, the boss of the SS. So, fascinating. He also, of course, Anthony Sutton, in some ways more famously, has done a lot of research on the Skull and Bone Society, which is this fraternity at Yale University, which our erstwhile mayor is also a Yaley guy. Here, Marvin Rees, the so-called Labour mayor of Bristol, the controlled opposition to the Conservatives, here in Bristol, also was a Yale boy, a Yale World Fellow. But Yale University contains the Skull and Bone Society, which is basically the Brotherhood of Death, is way Anthony Sutton describes it. And he then had to leave the Hoover Institution in the 1980s, and he was a very difficult person to interview, apparently. So there was only a short period where he dared to be interviewed, and that was when I think he'd just left the Hoover Institution, and that was, I think, that's Stanley Monteith interviewing him there as part of our Conspiracy Classics series. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Ian Henshaw, the author of 9/11 and New Evidence. A new e-book version is coming out in maybe 6 weeks or so's time. In time, anyway, for the 20th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks. Also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. To be included on my weekly email list, do send an email to me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. That's one word, Culture Shop. And you'll find that address on the contact tab at www.thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or a story that you'd like to share with our audience, do think there's anything that I've missed or have got a correction, please do email me with a link or two, and even a scan of what you've got if possible. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car, home, anywhere you like. Once you've got that LMP3, then you will find not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and all our contact details at the show page, thisweek.org.uk, plus the longer versions of tonight's interviews with Stanley Laham, etc. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My book, After 30 Years of Research into the Origins of the Bilderbergers and the Links to the World War II Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback now, priced £15, including postage. And you can also get my Siege of Heaven reader book in paperback too. That's £20. You can find those, as you can just about any book in the world, on bookfinder.com. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com. Do please make live recordings of the stream. We have been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses. The glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
In the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
That only force
riot.
Will make him leave.
Right!
I am certain our cause is just a gallon of gas, and I am certain our cause is moral,
loss of life.
And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity.
Again.
Kind of demoralizing the whole country.
Corruption.
Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
Power. It's up to you. Choice. It's up to you. Change the world. It's up to you.
Please do your part.
What the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
There's a time
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
How do you feel?
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
Let me tell you
what it is.
Power.
It's up to you.
You. Up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Up to you.
You.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Up to you.
Power!
Do what's right.
It's up to you.
You.
One more time.
Power.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
Let's hear it.
Choice.
What a group of kids we've sent out into the world.